Week in Confirmed is brought to you by Game Center, the must-have app for gamers. Game Center is filled with game information, the latest gaming news from ShackNews.com, and videos and screenshots for over 7,000 games. Game Center is free and available now for the iPhone, Android, and Palm mobile devices.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
We can confirm.
Ignition. Liftoff. Liftoff.
All right, everybody, welcome to an awesome Weekend Confirmed, coming to you from our fabulous studios just blocks off the beach in Santa Monica, where it's a beautiful day here in sunny summer California.
It's a little, there's a little cloud layer, but it's pretty nice.
It was beautiful today. Come on. Traffic certainly indicated that it was a beach day.
Yeah.
Certainly. And we are celebrating here with our friends from Fireball Whiskey, who have generously provided yet another bottle of rocket fuel.
Firing it up.
They are firing it up for us with their cinnamon whiskey. So that is Mr. Jeff Cannata to my left.
Yeah, on Twitter, at Jeff Cannata with two N's and one T.
And then, because we had Mr. Corey Davis, who is the lead designer from Spec Ops The Line, in last week, we brought in two expert media members who have played Spec Ops The Line to discuss this very game. And Corey, if you're going to be listening, you're probably going to hate me after this. I mean, actually, Corey is a listener, so he's going to be listening. But anyway, I brought in some guys to give the other side of it, and that would be none other than television's illustrious Adam Sessler.
Illustrious?
Yes.
I'm really now kind of the wandering Jew of games journalism, but I'll go for illustrious television guy. Okay, thank you, Garnet.
And you may know him from EGM, and where else have you done stuff?
Oh, God. Walmart Game Center, Rides Magazine, Emmy Magazine, Maxim Bikini stuff.
Maxim.
You can see his spreads in all these magazines.
I was on the cover a couple times. God, Games Radar, PlayStation Official Magazine, Shaq News now.
Suffice to say, he gets around.
I'm a big slut.
That's Paul Semmel.
Hello.
First timer club.
All right. So, crew, we have a lot to get through here. Clearly, Spec Ops The Line will be our lead off, so we do not leave that hanging. We're going to talk about violence in games. We have other games that you guys have played, including Quantum Conundrum. And, we might get into some Inversion since Paul played it. We need to have something else to joke about. Adam's been playing a bunch of stuff while he's on his leisure tour. We might talk about some Max Payne 3 because I got it this week on Amazon's Gold Box sale and I'm excited to play it. But Jeff Cannata is a notorious meh on Max Payne 3.
Notorious meh.
Notorious meh. And who knows what other wondrous things we might get into. So let's kick her off. All right. So what we've been playing is Spec Ops The Line. And if you remember last week, Corey Davis from Jaeger, they're the designers or the studio that created the game out of Germany, was here. And he gave us really one of the best developer guests we've had on the show, primarily, obviously, because he understands the show and really gets it. So that was a great mesh and we had a great time talking with him. And I went into playing this game over the last week with very high expectations, and I am trying very hard to discount, the delta between my expectations and where it came in as a negative. But I found that so much of what he aspired to achieve with the game, as much as I appreciated that and got excited about that and then saw that reflected in some other folks in the media talking about it, was just a full-scale miss. And for me, Spec Ops The Line is just – it's indicative of – a shooter that is nothing more than a shooter and has all of the familiar underpinnings of a shooter and then adds this tremendous layer of unpleasantness under the guise of, well, that makes it dramatic.
Wow, that's pretty harsh. How do you reconcile that with his stated objective of really making the apocalypse now of shooters? I didn't have a chance to play it this week, unfortunately, but I'm curious to hear the whole spectrum of what you guys think. But I mean,
how do I reconcile it?
Yeah,
I reconcile it.
Do you see the intention there? Are you aware of the?
I reconcile with game production. I mean, honestly, at the end of the day, you have to make a game, and I think that what happened was they made a game. So some of the and I'm going to pitch this to Adam and Paul because they both have differing opinions. But one of the things that really stood out for me is that if I'm trying to be engaged on a more cerebral level than run down a corridor and shoot things, I need to have a little bit of connective tissue there. And having bog standard, you know, prototypical enemy types to the degree of my cohorts, my two squad mates calling out, here comes another shotgunner. And it's the same shotgunner with the same floppy, you know, floppy adventurer hat and the ammo vest with the little meshing on it and a shotgun. Oh, here comes another knife specialist. The knife specialist, of course, the guy who looks like he's a reject from Borderlands and runs across the runs across the gunfight with a knife at you. And if he gets to you, it's an insta-kill. But of course, it's just
Well, you can't blame the guy for that. He spent his whole life specializing in knives.
Knife specialist on the field.
And he shows up at a gunfight. It's not that's just bad planning.
He does run it with the knife at the ready. Like, perhaps you might move towards him and he'll finally be able to close that necessary distance.
It's kind of
interesting. I mean, I want to see a backstory about him. This kind of, you know, maybe like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, where it's just like he's been, or maybe like the guy in Raiders of the Lost Ark, like the real story of the actor who waited so long for this big fight. Harrison Ford is sick, and so I'm just gonna run the guy with an AK-47
tonight on Nat Geo Video Games. Knife guy, the insider story behind the blade.
So, Paul, you had a different perspective.
Well, I had a different perspective because I didn't hear your guys' podcast. I didn't read a lot about this game, and I didn't know all these sort of lofty expectations. So I just went into it thinking, okay, it's a shooter, and I actually had a lot of fun with it. Because the thing for me was, mechanically, that you were right. It doesn't sort of do anything that we haven't already done before. What I liked was sort of where you were having these fights. Like, it was sort of a little bit different at times. Like, when you were on top of, like, the rooftops and, like, you know, in this sort of disaster zone. And you know, when you get
Dubai.
Into... Yeah, exactly. And, like there's a couple times when, like, you'd be... you know, in a firefight with guys during like a sandstorm, you couldn't really see anything. I thought that was really cool. I don't think they did that stuff enough. I mean, you spend most of the time inside a building that's been, you know, obviously demolished and damaged, and it gives it a very post-apocalyptic feel that we've felt before. But again, I didn't have kind of these lofty things hanging over my head, so I didn't know. Like, I knew that there was something to do with the Heart of Darkness. But having not read the book, and I've seen, obviously, Apocalypse Now, I didn't sort of have those expectations. So when I came across some of that stuff, I was kind of like,
what do you mean came across? It slaps you in the face with so many unpleasant scenes. How did you deal with that?
Well, I mean, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
So not having that expectation then, I'm even more curious, like not having the expectation that this was supposed to be something of a higher plane.
Right.
How did you deal with, like, just the raw, like... in-your-face war atrocities, horrible depictions of burned and charred bodies
right, right.
and killing all these American soldiers. By the way, spoiler, you are basically throughout the game killing American soldiers.
Which are supposed to be renegade and they've gone rogue and they're, you know, and you get this, over time you also get the sense that they've all gone stark raving mad, especially
Or you have.
Or you have. I mean, that's the thing. I thought that aspect of the game actually worked. I didn't see it so much as the horrors of war. And I also felt it was fairly light in terms of its true relation to Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. Probably was a
Definitely.
Little bit more related to Apocalypse Now. I guess the one thing is, I've always become, as an English major who loves Conrad, it still kills me how much that poor book has actually been turned into Apocalypse Now in every student's head, because they'll just go watch the movie instead. But I digress there.
A good digression,
I liked the way that it began more as a military shooter. And, you know, okay, no big whoop. But I felt that the combat started to take on a different tone as it went on, because the character you're playing seems to be driven more and more by a strange obsession and pathology about trying to get this General Conrad. And that thing that everyone comments about, that I think really came up with the first Uncharted, where Nathan Drake is kind of like, hey, I'm Indiana Jones, and I'm about to murder 100,000 people.
Right.
And I think they address that in Uncharted 2, and in this... You start to feel that, I don't know, there's an odd kind of feeling about the, you know, all these people you're mowing down. I felt that it didn't change the video game style of the shooter, but it gave a little bit more meaning to that, kind of the way that a good horror movie stands out over a middling one.
There's no dramatic meter to this. It's just kill after kill after kill after kill after kill. There's no there's no contrast, right? It's all just all black killing. It's all black killing all the time. There's no let up. There's no humanization. We were talking about it outside. There's no humanization to allow for me to be dehumanized.
But I guess I like the idea that you're having this battle inside of the archetypes. I mean, Apocalypse Now is enough in this game that Conrad is the bad guy of that mold, and you are the hero who's trained, who's, I believe they're not Rangers. Yeah,
they're Delta Force.
That there is a sense that these guys are going in with their training and all that, and that you're not supposed to see them so much as human beings, but those avatars of adventure that somehow gets perverted and distorted as the narrative goes on. I mean, I think the real issue with the game is technically it had a ton of flaws for me. I played on normal where, from what I understand, I was supposed to do a snap lock when I go into Iron Sights, just as you get with Call of Duty. And I would get it just off to the side of the guy, and you did not have delicate controls that you could just get that, and you have to get headshots in this game. Mm-hmm. You are very vulnerable. And, you know, that aspect was disappointing because you're replaying scenes over and over again. And given how strong the narrative is, that weakens, I think, the storytelling when you're having to revisit the same time five or six times just because of one slight error.
But if you're thinking that Delta Force as this, you know, highly focused, very trained, able to deal with the situation for us, how do you reconcile that with the drop off the side of the cliff face into ridiculously bad decisions that the narrative presumes that you're going to stomach? Because very quickly, for me, the way I internalized this game and interpreted it was, we are cast as this soldier who is put into a situation and initially tries to make what he thinks are good decisions, but it doesn't accept that he made an initially bad read and then continues trying to find the one person he can put a bullet in to justify it all. And he's never going to find it. So he keeps on firing more bullets, keeps on trying to find the right one that if I just kill the right guy, it's all going to make sense. But it never will.
I like the way
how many games get you to talk like that about them? I think that's exactly the goal that Corey was talking about, right? You're discussing the game in terms that you don't talk about video games.
I think that was the ideal. It so poorly handles it that I don't. So that's supposed to be the ideal, right? Except that what happens is instead of killing anyone that has any meaning to me whatsoever, they're just generic people coming at me. There's no weight to it. There's no sensibility to it. There's no juxtaposition of. So I thought about this because we're going to use the Vietnam movie analogy. So let's continue that comparison. There's a few things there that are really important to me in structure that I think make those things work. So let's look at an Apocalypse Now. First of all, Martin Sheen gets his instructions at the very outset of the movie. And no matter how weird shit gets, you did at least have this fundamental understanding of here's what I'm going to. And then the river serves as the backbone around which everything else lies. And because you have that backbone and because you have the boat moving down the backbone to which we always return, no matter how far afield we stray, I can go all over the place and be in crazy situations, but I have that grounding to come back to, which allows me as the viewer to parse it all. And you can't parse this game because it's always just batshit insane.
Well, no, and you do have an interesting point there because obviously I think with Conrad and definitely with Apocalypse Now that you can see sort of Homer's Odyssey.
Right.
The idea that you do have the episodic stops. And one thing that I think a lot of games could take better instruction from is that structure where we want to have our set pieces in games, but sometimes you just feel that they're being strung together by the most flimsy of narratives. Yeah. To be honest, the Odyssey is a pretty flimsy narrative. Can't get home. Oh, no, we're pigs. Yeah. Hold on, the witch wants to sleep with me, and now the ladies are singing, I'm getting naked.
Right.
I mean, but it works. And I think had they kind of looked at it that way and not, I think they may have pulled too far away from the source material.
Possibly.
And that maybe, you know, to use that as a greater foundation, I think there might have been stronger set pieces because when the game, I found that moments the game really worked, but there were contrasting moments where I felt like, okay, I'm going through some stuff to get to that next moment. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think your case that you start to see the more rote elements of the game really come to the forefront.
And then there are also great contrasting elements. And this was my thing about I have to be humanized to be dehumanized. There are so many great moments, and albeit they don't have to be long, and maybe games need to find ways to handle these in different ways, but there are the moments when Sheen's in the cabin in the PT boat writing in his diary. Or there's the barbecue where they're all sitting around having beers. And there are these moments that add a human element to these people such that when you actually get to the killing, it has impact. And there's no impact to it here because you start off and right from the bat, you're just mowing down dudes. You're just mowing people down. I'm just shooting people, mowing them down. Hey, look, there's some burned out mom with her baby in her hands that we white phosphorus. Whoops. Move on to the next kill.
So you're saying that it's kind of trapped inside its own genre. It's trapped because it's a third person action game. And even though he was trying to sort of use that pattern, that template in order to comment, make a comment that's usually not made in that kind of game, that it's sort of restricted by its own form. Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was restricted by falling back on the form of wanting to, at the end of the day, someone saying, well, we're still a shooter. We are going to be compared to Call of Duty. We need to be a Call of Duty. And on that count, it doesn't live up for those reasons that Adam started to talk about. Like, you know, the fundamental mechanic of shooting in this game, really not as good as a top tier shooter. Is it? It's maybe a little bit better than Homefront, but it's certainly not up to where a Call of Duty is at this point in stage.
Or Gears of War, which really is much closer to. And now, the one thing I did like about the game in terms of its gameplay is it's very cover-based. I mean, you're out of cover for probably more than 5 seconds. You're dead.
Toast.
You're absolutely dead. But it's also much faster than what you get from Gears of War.
Yeah.
You are moving out of cover and having to read your environment. And there was something very, very exciting about that, which I also did. When it was doing that right and the aiming was working, suddenly, once again, you had that nice thrust that was also kind of present there in the narrative. I do think that what you don't like about the game was affected more by issues in the gameplay than I think were immediately evident. I mean, it
probably.
Just, if that game moved at a steady clip and I wasn't constantly having to reload just to get to the next part, I think the story would have gone down a little bit more easily. But when you're reloading the same scene 5 times, you're shooting 5 times more people right in the face. So, I mean, that's
true. But you're always a late observer to everything that happened here. You're never seeing anything in present tense in the game. And it's part of this whole game that they're playing throughout the course of the narrative of keeping you off your balance and keeping you confused, because they're so caught up in trying to paint this confusion picture and where you don't know what's going on that they ultimately make this confusing, muddling mess. There's this whole side story with the CIA that comes in through the middle arc of the game that ultimately becomes next to unimportant. I mean, the resolution of that is absurd, number one, and the whole thing just really doesn't have any play, and it's very hard to figure out where the factions were, and not because of some ambiguity with the morals, but simply because they just make the whole damn thing confusing. Besides, and that's throwing out how ridiculous the ending is. I mean, the ending is ridiculous. I think the ending is ridiculous.
It can be seen as ridiculous.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because when I got to the ending, I wondered if you went back and played the game again, knowing what happens, whether it would hold together. Because I don't know that it would.
And I know, see, but that's what I'm thinking. And this is, I think it depends on how you approach the game. If you think it's kind of a genre game that's trying to have loftier aspirations, or if it's lofty aspirations trapped in a genre game. I mean, that's the latter is, I think, how you see it, Garnet. And I guess I still saw it as a shooter, but when you try to add a little bit more and change it, it just becomes what I'm so used to playing made a little more interesting. I think of movies like, say, To Live and Die in L.A., which I think is just one of the best cop movies ever, because it has a little bit more. You know, when you look at, you know, some of the horror movies of David Cronenberg, they're genre, but there's some sense of philosophy, something that's underpinning it. Though we may not say that they are the best movies ever made up there with Citizen Kane, but they feel a little more nourishing, and there's something to chew on. If we think that, as they were trying to say from Jaeger, that they're going in about to, you know, do Apocalypse Now, and then you end up with, hey, this is pretty much a third-person shooter, that does feel like a step down.
Well, yeah. But what I love about Live and Die in L.A. is that you have those moments where you become attached to those characters out of the context of all those things, and you see the human element. You
and
see
I think
the
human that's we all came away from E3 lauding
Last of Us.
Yeah.
I was about to.
And I think that that's where we're all seeing the potential there is, because all the stuff we've seen leading up to that game, it looks like there's going to be lots of those moments where you're just sort of being a human being with this girl and you know, having experiences in the city that allow you to sort of be human and be in an extraordinary situation, but still not have to be shooting something every 2 seconds. And then when the actual encounters happen, it doesn't just fall into established third person action game tropes. While you can play it that way, and to a certain extent, you're forced to sort of deal with it in a fresh context. And I think that's the distinction that, because a lot of people I think don't understand why so many of us are really excited about that game. From what showed on stage,
it's small moments that I think you have to be right in front of that game to catch it.
Yes, exactly.
And if you come at it, so I think that coming at it from the direction you did of it being a genre game with higher expectations, then I still have trouble, because then in that case, as a genre game, I start to break down things like the mechanics of it.
And that's where I was most disappointed by the game, because those things, I mean, I assumed the fundamentals were going to be covered.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm a little, I mean, obviously this game has been delayed several times, and to see that targeting issue, and I don't really understand what happens in the development of a game that when it comes to matters like that, but that was a little surprising, because that should be one of the first things that you're trying to overcome is good, solid controls that once the player is comfortable with that, you can then go on to all the challenges that you want to put in their face, but they never feel they have command over those controls. Well, you're going to have the player fighting all the way through the game.
And that being the case, one of their star features was the sandstorm. And I would say absolutely the most exciting and best moments of the genre-style game took place in those sandstorms. What they did in the sandstorms was really, really cool and clever and interesting. And I felt like almost felt like inside the head of the designers, they hit on this and they're like, this is really cool. And they said to themselves, maybe, well, we don't want to come back to it too much and wear out our welcome. And unfortunately, they did just the opposite, was they didn't use it enough to even get to where they were wearing their welcome.
Now,
I'd agree with that.
I mean, if memory serves me right, they were originally showing this game off with the dynamic sand, and that was a big selling point.
Yeah,
this was years ago. I remember thinking at the time, this is cool. Technologically, is this truly feasible? There's parts of this game that I'm like, wow, if this was next gen, after seeing something like Watch Dogs or whatever, what's the Star Wars game? Something 13.
13.
Something 13.
You know, when you start 13. To see what you can start to do, what we're now imagining can be done with physics and more independent animations, that I think this could have really kind of found its way with the next generation of technology.
Sure.
I mean, I like the idea of the sandstorm, but I didn't buy the physics of the sandstorm, and you didn't get to have those nice moments where you're using, like, the, you know, shooting out the glass and the sand's coming in and it's filling it up. Because once again, if you're burying all those people, I think that's supposed to invoke some sense of what happened on the Highway of Death in Desert Storm, and when people were getting buried by the bulldozers. And yeah, it was kind of like, those are just kind of bad animations, and you don't really get the sense that you did something pretty awful to a group of people, even if they were shooting at you.
Hmm. Well, we did actually stir up a hornet's nest, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's to the game's credit in a certain respect, you know?
I think we're in the midst of that by virtue of having had Corey on and by virtue of wanting to dig deeper and look underneath the hood here. You know, overall still
and guys, it's also June. There is nothing else out there. I mean, there is that.
I mean, I think that, you know, part of the reception that I've been struggling to deal with is that, look, those of us who have this as adults as our hobby, we really yearn for something like this to take it up to a next level, to be able to handle these topics in a good way. It's the sort of discussions we had about Tomb Raider as well, where it's like, yes, there's a sexual assault in it, and we should be able to deal with that because that is an important part of the drama here. It's a part of her maturation. It's a part of who she's going to be in establishing your character and all of these elements. And I think that Spec Ops The Line falls into that trap of then being adolescent about it, because of the fact that it just reduces it to a game. It just reduces it to, I'm going to mow down. I mean, at the end of this game, you have single-handedly defeated an entire corps of the United States government's army. That's ridiculous. And if you're trying to get me to buy into things...
Remember, Medal of Honor, you took out the Germans.
I get it. Yeah. I get
like
it.
Like the entire Germans that were like in Holland.
But what I'm saying
but that's
is,
historically accurate.
What I'm saying is if you're trying to like jump me up a level, then... And again, if I'm supposed to be Delta Force, I needed a little bit of pace. I needed a little bit more gradual descent into that heart of darkness other than just, well, I made a mistake. Everybody here is bad. I'm killing them all.
No, and I don't want to hang on the Tomb Raider thing, but I think that really is good at illustrating it. It's not that this idea of sexual assault in games is fundamentally wrong. It's that there's only a few hands that can do it without getting that kind of adolescent sensibility, exactly, or that it's done for titillation, or that you don't fully appreciate the significance and horror of that act.
Right.
And that's exactly the thing. And that's where the problems with Tomb Raider were. And that's where one can have a very legitimate, you know, discussion about Spec Ops, because it does deal with things like white phosphorus, which is a horrible, horrible thing. And whether or not this really did demonstrate the horror, or if it may have actually just kind of minimized it by its inclusion in the game, I'm not going to take a side on that, but I think it is a very valid discussion that, you know, when do we go that far and who gets to go that far?
I would say that it sort of glosses it as a effective area of effect attack system that takes out your enemies really well. And there's a couple of scenes that are gruesome. But
I think it's also...
See, but I thought that the fact that they included those gruesome scenes was kind of interesting and rather bold, because a lot of games wouldn't have done that. Sure. A lot of games, you know, you would have done the stuff to these people, it would have been horrible, and then you would have moved on to the next fight, whereas they actually did, you know, make you walk slowly through this field and see all these bodies and burning. And whether or not it really had the desired effect is up for the viewer to decide. But I thought it was much more interesting that they included that than not, because there are a lot of people who do not want to know that war is a horrible thing.
Sure.
They do not want to know that war has human cost. And I think there are going to be people who will get to that part, and if they use the white phosphorus and then have to go through this, are going to be like, oh, I don't want to play this. They're going to be offended by it.
I'm sure you played Modern Warfare 2.
Mm-hmm.
What separates this from One Russian?
Or No Russian?
No Russian.
From actually, I think both of them are undone by a similar flaw. I think No Russian would have been more effective had it been more graphic, not with blood, but with animations. Mm. I wish that scene... And this could have been a technological limitation, but I think it was something to consider. The bodies needed to fall like bodies would actually fall in a situation like that to really come across how horrible that sequence is. My issue in Spec Ops is, and this is just a funny issue with the game as a whole, the textures are kind of not very vibrant nor distinctive. And I think that to really convey that horror...
It's not the greatest Unreal Engine game.
No, I wish the Unreal Engine had been pushed, because there's something more impressionistic than realistic about what you see following the white phosphorus that probably is more palatable to most people, but does, I think, minimize some of the level of shock.
Well, I disagree with that on a theoretical level, because I think you can have an effect on people by abstracting, and you can have an effect on people by using metaphor, and it doesn't have to be...
I agree with that, but they are clearly, in both cases, they're going for realism and fall very short of it. I completely agree that you can find abstract and metaphorical ways to convey that, but they did not go on that path, and they didn't go as far as that path needed for them to go on.
Paul, any redeeming characteristics to the multiplayer?
Well, I like the fact that they had the sandstorms in it,
that's cool,
which was fun. And they also had the things where you could shoot windows out and dump sand on people, which, you know, I thought was an interesting mechanic. And again, it had the sort of areas that were outdoors and you're, you know, running around what's kind of a beachy apocalypse kind of thing. But otherwise, it was what you kind of expected.
So tough to be a shooter in multiplayer and not be named Call of Duty or Halo.
Well,
or...
and it's a shame, because we get the sense that games can only survive with this multiplayer that is successful twice, maybe three times a year.
Yeah.
I mean, I would love to see that conundrum worked out.
Absolutely. Speaking of conundrums.
So how do you like that? There you go. It's a great lead for coming back. I want to talk about violence, though, so when we come back on the next side and do that. Spec Ops The Line, though, wrapping it up for me, is a miss on the narrative side from the carnage not paying off with a like really impacting, you know, like really strong narrative payoff. And then on the flip side, it's just not a fun enough shooter. There are too many frustrating moments in the aiming controls. There are too many poorly designed combat scenarios. And by the way, the load times also are abysmal between when you die. It's a long reload, really long reload. Anyway, that's my call on it. Paul's into it.
I liked it. It was a really fun shooter. It's definitely one I want to play a second time, and part because it was kind of short, you know. And I'd like to see sort of if I made different narrative choices, what would have played out at the end. Although there's a whole mess of endings, so, you know.
And Adam, you're in between?
I would say I think this is probably the most discussable game this year since Mass Effect 3. For good or ill. I think it's doing some interesting things that people who would like to see where the industry could go. I'm not saying it succeeds at that, but this is still one that I think is an important enough one, especially at this point in the year, to check it out. I'm not saying it's perfect. It's not that.
Give us a chance to pour ourselves a second round, and we will come right back on the other side with a little discussion of violence in games and move on to fluffy worlds and gods and who knows what else. Stick around, Weekend Confirmed. We'll be right back. Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers. The app is filled with game information, the latest gaming news from shacknews.com, and videos and screenshots for over 8,000 games. New version 2.0 for the iPhone and iPod Touch includes cool new features like social interaction. Now you can follow and interact with the crew from Weekend Confirmed in the Gamefly app. Check out what Jeff Cannata, Del Rio, and I are playing and saying about the latest games. And as always, the app is free and available now for the iPhone, Android, and Palm mobile devices. All right, I hope you enjoyed that discussion about Spec Ops: The Line, and we will wrap it up with a couple of things here. We talked about Last of Us, and in the so we had a thread that started up in the Shack News Weekend Confirmed official show thread last week about violence, and I thought this was applicable, and it turns out to really have fit well. Papaya Pablo said, "Last of Us violence makes you uncomfortable. It's treating violence in a much deeper way. It's uncomfortable because it has to be. It's horrible because it really is. You can avoid it, but you really don't want to, or you really want to. And then when you do have to kill, you really feel you couldn't avoid it." And that is the differentiating point, one of the big differentiating points here. We're talking about, like, why do we look at Last of Us and think it's so big? It's
because, I mean, of course, we're extrapolating from seeing a short game.
Yeah,
but no, he's actually played the whole thing.
It's probably a focus group over there.
I'm just saying that we're setting ourselves up to be massively disappointed in this game if it doesn't live up to that. But I really feel like it's of this new generation of adult games, of games that have grown up a little bit.
Yeah.
And are handling the subject matter with a little bit of responsibility.
Yeah. And it is Naughty Dog. This was, once again, coming from a less than vaunted group. I mean, look, they killed themselves to make Uncharted 2. The fact that they got Uncharted 3 done, I think, in even less time.
Amazing.
Even though I thought it was the lesser of the games. But, I mean, I think they know they have set the bar very, very high, and they just are. That's one of the few devs, I think, that will meet that challenge. And I want them to so badly.
Yeah, me too.
But I think what stood out to me about the demo we saw at E3 is that the pace of it, the nature of it, the body count is lower. But not only is the body count lower, you get this real sense of character. And maybe it's just the way they laid it out. Again, we're taking a lot from a short demo. However, they take the time, you know, in the beginning to have those character building moments between, I don't mean like protagonist and the girl. I mean, what are their names?
I'm blanking on the names anyway.
I
think of the voice actor's name.
Ellen Page.
Yeah, like Ellen Page, obviously. But they have the moment in the pickup truck before this stuff happens. Yodi. So you start again, and then Yodi. even the casual dialogue amongst them while they're you know under duress is not combat attack. And maybe part of it's disarming is the fact that they're just citizens. They're not supposed to be Delta Force. They're not supposed to be hardened soldiers, you know? So there's a greater degree of identifiability there.
I think a lot, too, about what the game makes it speak, words in right order, please. A lot of what makes the
teeth
game so special is what Adam was referencing earlier, is those details. It's those little details that, you know, of what the NPC says or how he says it or how he behaves or how you find the brick on the ground and the detail of how your character acts and just the way he's animated. All of it doesn't say super soldier, says average person in extraordinary situation. And even your enemies aren't evil killing machine. They're person who made different choice in extraordinary situation, you know. So it's such a human moment because of those details that you feel like you have to handle those characters in a more humane way. Mm-hmm. And I hope the whole game feels that way. And I hope that there isn't just this drop off to where, okay, now we're all zombies and you can just kill
us. Yeah, if once again, I don't expect them to do it. I mean, as long as they don't do the 28 days later, oh, look, who's the real monster now? I'm so tired of that. Yes, people suck. Zombies are worse. End of story.
Well, I also don't want them to do the end of Uncharted games where it's like, oh, remember how we've been fighting this? Now everybody's supernatural and it's all crazy pants and go have crazy go nuts.
I mean, I think it's very intriguing that they haven't shown what the infected are. And the fact that they call them infected does give them that room that they're not proper zombies. And hopefully they're not, you know, what was the Will Smith movie? It was the remake of
I Am Legend.
Yeah. I just don't make them vampires because that's stupid.
Well, they were vampires
only
by virtue of
the book.
They were vampires in the movie. They were what mutated from some government like militarized strain of
it was a
infection.
Cancer medicine.
Oh, it was cancer medicine. That's right. Yeah. Not militarized. It was his
cancer medicine actually.
And he was fixing it. He was going to fix it.
He was going to fix it.
Oh, irony.
In the movie, not in the original book.
But even there, now human moments. Even there, you get those human moments. You get him out with the dog, and like you have. That's an important thing. We want human moments in our games.
It's a very difficult thing to convey in something that requires action every.
Well, it
few
has
seconds.
That push pull. It has that push pull of gameplay of how much time do we take control out of the game player's hands? How often do we?
The trick is to do it and not take control out of the game player's hands. Because
like what we were talking about in the break, like all the sandstorm mechanic gave them this fantastic way for this little group of Delta Force to move through the city and have a legitimate way to be undetected or to get away when they were detected, because sandstorm like basically wiped out everything, took out radar, it took out radio, it took out everything. So all of a sudden these guys could have gotten away. They could have been someplace they shouldn't have been, seen something they shouldn't have seen, and then gotten away through a sandstorm. And we could have had those moments while I was still controlling it. And I could have been that guy. Oh, God, I got to get the fuck out of here.
Think about getting off the train in City 17 for the first time.
Oh,
you know,
so
that's
good.
You immediately start to feel what it must be like to live in that city. And it's a very simple, very short sequence. And just how those guards deal with you and what you're forced to, you know, how you're forced to move through that situation and the constant voiceover of the guy sort of, you know, oppressing the town. There are ways to do it without it being a cutscene. I feel like that's the secret sauce, is not have it be just sit back and set your controller down and watch.
I think, though, you could have a cutscene. I think Naughty Dog does this very well. If it's entertaining, I don't notice that I'm not playing. But, you know, so many cutscenes. Metal Gear Solid 4.
Yeah.
Josh, kind of, it's like, okay, this real...
Inversion, for example, has...
Well, I mean, look at what James Cameron did in the first Terminator movie. He put all of the exposition in the middle of a chase scene.
Yeah.
You know? So you were still, you know, entertained.
Yeah.
But you were also learning what's going on. Whereas
he had to explain, like, here's the whole history of what happened with the apocalypse and the rise of Skynet and why these guys are trying to kill John Connor. And by the way, you're on this crazy chase scene.
Right. Whereas a lot of movies, it's like the people will practically like sit down for dinner and be like, okay, so here's like what happened, blah, blah, blah. And that scene gets really boring. And
it's My Dinner with Andre.
Yeah.
Which is my favorite movie, by the way.
It's not, but My Dinner with Andre is so not boring.
It's one of my, it's in my top three movies of all time.
I have seen more movies with explosions that bore me more than Wallace Shawn and Andre, what's his last
name? Gregory.
Gregory. Sorry, I almost said Previn. I knew that wasn't right.
If you haven't seen that film, I watch it once a year. It is amazing.
It is very good, but I was making a quick point.
Snarky joke based in not in reality.
I think, though, if you look at what happened this week with the release of the Steam Filmmaker, that obviously the tools are really evolving very quickly for media being made within game engines. And as we push forward with that, I think we're going to continue to open doors for designers to incorporate staged event happenings with us in control of how we are interacting with what's going on in there.
So I love like staged event happenings.
I'm trying to think about how to say this. Like I think I'm thinking about like Machinima, right? And Machinima is done inside a game engine, and there are folks who are the camera within the game engine, and they are filming as they move around to see those scenes. And then there are cutscenes like we see in Metal Gear Solid 4. And there's going to be an increasing way to someone's dumb designer is going to crack the nut of how do I give the player enough cueing to know where they should be to observe the right parts of what they want to observe, because they're in the character and they're interested in what's going on, and they're there as if they are 3D and in part of this movie that's taking place before I give them the control back and they shoot somebody.
I mean, that's kind of what BioShock Infinite is promising, that, you know, the famous demo from last year,
mm-hmm.
that many of those things, the playing around with the Lincoln mask, would not happen were you not adjacent to the girl while she was next to that object.
Yeah.
And granted, we haven't seen the demo done various ways to know how well that's more out. But yeah, I mean, that really sounds like what everyone is striving for.
Like we would all be our own character actors within machinimas. And I think that's possible. I think we could get to a point where we did that, and then we could have a continuing evolution of what sort of stories we're telling, what sort of characters we have in the game.
And I think that would also start to address the violence issue as posed by Pablo Papaya. Did I get that right?
Yes, Pablo Papaya. Papaya.
Yes, I didn't know it was the other way around, because it takes on such a different meaning. Papaya, Pablo.
Papaya. Or Gray's Papaya.
But, I mean, I think that starts to build that sense of consequence that, you know, things become less and less like avatars and things are supposed to take a bullet in the face,
yep.
than things that you may have built up a relationship with, or that threat that I could have learned something interesting or had a unique interaction, but, oh, I set him on fire, so that's not going to happen.
But I also think that...
Oh, but I set him on fire.
I think that as evocative as film can be and as impactful as watching a cutscene can be when done right, I think we're going to find, as this industry continues to mature, that none of that is going to be able to approach me being inside that experience and interacting with it in real time, and that as... film will be what it is, but we will have this interactive thing happening, this interactive narrative form that will evolve into being so much more personal, because I'm actually standing there and deciding to look at her, put that thing on her face, or standing there and, you know,
You just wrote Shatner's Tech Wars.
You're welcome.
Here's the funny thing, and this has been, I'm getting milder and milder with this apprehension, but with Last of Us, you know, I was like, God, can I play this game for more like than an hour and a half at a time? You know, does it become so dour? Does it, you know, because this world is so well articulated, does it start to seep into me? I would feel that way with games that didn't do it as well, like Fallout 3 and the Condemned games, where there's like, okay, I'm going to go shower now and maybe hug a puppy, because, you know, because games are kind of like going over to someone's house. And when you think of your friends that have smelly houses,
zombie house,
you don't hang out that much. Yeah. And, you know, so I mean, it's a tricky balance, but I think it speaks to the idea that we get our experiences in 2 hours with a movie, yet we want 15 hours with a game, even though the kind of schedule in our lives make it very hard to get through those games. That, you know, if we have these even more engrossing experiences, can we have them shorter, and will they be commercially successful? You know, because they're that much more interesting. I mean, I don't know if you can really take that concept out where I'm really interacting with the movie, and that technically or creatively, it can actually handle 15 hours worth of gameplay.
Okay, well, then let's jump to this question, which is one of my favorites. Like, what the hell is it going to take for good episodic content to work in the video game space?
I have no idea.
I think Halo 4 has got a pretty interesting take on it.
But Halo 4 is built on top of a $60 retail game.
Right, right.
Like, I mean, what's it going to take? And I understand from having spoken with a number of developers and publishers the difficulty that it's posed of game versus, you know, even like a high drama with a high production value of, look, a game, so much of the effort is front loaded. So much of the monetary commitment is front loaded in building the engine and building the resources and building the tools, that once they've cranked out 2 hours, they might as well crank out 8 or 10 hours and make it a $60 game. Because if they only sell you the first 2 hours and then people start dropping off, they're never going to get even close to the curve they need to hit. But if they did it right, like...
marketing. I mean, I think it's a lot of it. Let's think of new
scheduling.
Television shows that seem to get an audience. Mad Men. You know, I mean, look,
there's just as many television shows that don't get an audience.
Right,
exactly.
Right, that's what I'm saying. But the thing is, at least some of them, most of the ones that get an audience, to my mind, I was aware of them existing prior to, you know, them actually coming out.
So back in my head,
you can't have video game pilot season. You can't have 50 games.
Yeah, but
being
you could
made
have these things.
You could
have
the engine.
Who knew that Sin episode 1 actually was made available on Steam?
Well, I did, but I'm an advocate. People who listen know that I loved Sin episodes because I thought it was so. I thought it was going to work.
Did
and
they
it
have
didn't.
Episode 2?
No, they never made.
Okay, that's
but,
what I
but
thought.
One thing I've noticed is no one's done it on a regular schedule.
Telltale.
Telltale, yeah, but, and Telltale's been successful.
But even with Telltale,
games.
It's like they do it and they're like, okay, we're going to have a second one. But it's not like every month there's a new one. It's not like The Walking Dead, you know, the first of every month it's coming out, like with a TV show.
Well, that's why Halo is so exciting.
Right.
Because I think they've kind of cracked that nut. And yes.
It's side story stuff,
right.
Which is good.
But it's going to be out every single week on the same exact day at the same time, like a TV show.
And their commitment is amazing. 10 weeks, 50 missions.
Yeah, 12 hours of gameplay.
Is this under the assumption that when this starts, 10 of them are already banked?
Yes.
That is such a strong promise.
Although Ellis seems to indicate that they basically have a very streamlined production cycle.
You have to make it work.
Yeah.
Oh, of course you do.
But I do think that they go season one is basically done, and we're thinking about season two right now, which will be the paid season that we'll all have to pony up for.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't imagine that they're not sort of set with where they're headed with season one.
It's also Halo. You know,
exactly. So it is Halo, which is going to have a huge base right off the bat. It's piggybacking onto a $60 game. It's piggybacking in the hopes of selling then season two and maybe a season three.
But that's how you do episodic content successfully the first time is you have to piggyback on an established...
I'm listening. I'm cool.
Yeah. A powerhouse that can sort of sell the concept to people and then the little guys can go, oh, okay, well, that's a proven business model.
No, Jeff's right. I mean, like, two of the most high-profile examples of, you know, episodic games or the attempts at episodic games, Sin, and God knows how many times they've done it with Duke Nukem. Probably not the strongest franchises to try to prove the episodic model on, and that you do need probably Call of Duty episodes, Assassin's Creed episodes, especially a game with such a good narrative that you want to come back for it.
Well, they are selling Assassin's Creed episodes. They're just called yearly $60 games.
But
there's another thing, and actually, I think it was one of the guys working on the Hitman game this week said that he and the rest of the people on the team only expect about 20 people to finish the game.
And 20 people?
20%.
She said 20.
Oh, or 20 people. Or 20
there might
people.
Be 100 well, people buying
if,
it.
If only 100 people buy it, then it will be 20. And you can buy me a Coke then. But his point was that he was not saying this like, oh, our game is so tough or terrible that this is going to happen. He was saying that this is indicative of these big games, that most games, people never get to the ending of the number of people who finish it. So maybe that's part of the problem with episodic content where, you know, if you put a game out – yeah, a bunch of people will buy the first one, but then less people will buy the next one.
So you're talking about the solution. This was a question. This was a conversation I had with Level Lord. What's his, Richard?
That guy. No, yeah. I'm talking. So we'll just call him Vegas in my
head.
We'll
call him Level Lord. But we had the same conversation, and there was one of the struggles they had with Sins was they were like laying out all this content, but they're like, well, shit, if nobody fucking plays this thing, they're never going to see this and this and this and then this.
But
we
that should be a solution, not the problem. If you're saying people only play a certain part of the game, and you're only putting out a certain part of the game, then.
But
it
you keep on wanting to shove
people to
but
play
if you're
that
wanting
part.
To make it successful, you keep on wanting to shove stuff into that to catch people, so they're like, oh, that was awesome.
Okay, to what we were talking about with Spec Ops.
Yeah.
I mean, there's that way in which each episode, it might have some narrative twists and turns, but are you getting fundamentally the same gameplay that you've kind of seen it all?
That's a good point.
Just going to see it 11 more times if you have a 12-episode cycle. If we start to see like, hey, no, this episode is all stealth, or this episode, you know, the lights are off. You know, that like, go look at... I mean,
that saves on graphics costs.
You know, there was the Batman issue. Snyder did it about 3 issues ago. And it was,
I'm not good on comic books.
Well, I was going to say, I was reading it on my... It's when he's with the owls and he's going all loopy-faced. But I was reading it on my iPad. And, you know, every time I would try to hold it upright, it would go upside down. Mm. And then I would try to write it, it would go upside down again.
That's
because
pretty cool.
And it was like this sense of something new. If they had something fresh, something that you kind of knew... You didn't know where it was going to go next. That's fun. But if you know, like, hey, I'm going to shoot a guy in the face, probably with lower fidelity graphics than what I got with my $60 game, that's not incentive.
Well, let me throw the other side of the argument out. If you're looking at it from sort of the proven track record of television, it's really only within the last 5 to 10 years that episodic narrative television has been serialized instead of compartmentalized. I mean, there's a reason that Law and Order – was okay, so massively successful
time out.
Because
1 second.
You get an episode and it's self-contained.
Please explain the differentiation you're making, because I'm not sure. I'm following, so I make sure everyone is listening.
Well, if you're watching
serializing versus...
If you're watching Mad Men or Breaking Bad or any of the shows that we all love nowadays, and you don't want to start watching with episode 7 because... It continued directly narratively from episode 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6.
Right.
It's like one long story, like they did with
exactly.
Lost, like they did with 24, where the entire season is one long story, as opposed to a Law and Order, where you can watch any episode in any order and for
now,
the
there
most
were,
part,
the whole history of television.
To be fair,
is that.
There were some early game breakers on that, like Homicide: Life on the Streets.
Oh. Right. Yes.
But
okay.
That
maybe
still
10
wasn't
years is
as
too short.
Strict to its narrative fidelity as
and we're not right. talking the last 50 years. I mean, we're talking 50 years of 75 years of television.
Lucy season 3 was not predicated
exactly.
on the events of Lucy season 1.
No television was. The whole point was selling into syndication was you.
Have you watched the Dick Van Dyke Show?
No, but I was just thinking, wouldn't it be cool though if in late seasons of I Love Lucy, it turns out she's heavily diabetic because of what happened at the Bon Bon Factory? It's like she ate so much. Chocolate that day.
Well, what if you? I mean, just to throw it out there, what if you did have a video game where you have a strong lead character, for example, the assassin from Assassin's Creed, whatever. Any take your pick of the assassins, or Batman, or whatever. And each game that comes out once a month, or whatever, once a week, whatever it is a 2-hour story that is self-contained and doesn't continue and. Is an adventure. Well, you buy
isn't that what they try with the Watchmen games ahead of the movie? I
oh,
mean,
yeah.
I think the problem is if they don't, no one's going to fund these games the right way to be able to get that kind of content. And for good reason. This is supposed to be low risk. You get out there on the market and you make some money back. And yeah. that, I think what would make them work would require the funding to make them an unprofitable, you know, agenda.
Yeah.
You also have to remember that with a lot of these serialized TV shows, the way a lot of people have experienced them is when they come out on DVD
sure.
and they have them all and they can watch them all. I mean, that's the thing that happened. It started with 24. People would, you know, get all, you know, the box set of one season and sit there for 24 hours and watch the whole thing. And I think that you might see that happen with serialized stuff. Like, I guarantee you there's people who are waiting for all of those Walking Deads to come out so they can sit there and play them all.
Yeah, yeah, the Telltale Walking Dead.
And actually,
yeah.
at one point, I think
totally
it was called,
true.
I think it was called Siren. It was like a PS3 downloadable survival horror game that was serialized, except they put out all 8 episodes at once.
Right.
That's how Netflix is going to be handling their episodic stuff with,
yeah, it's with
Eli
Lillehammer.
Roth and with David Fincher's
the
show.
David Fincher thing?
Yeah. They're going to dump them all out there at the same time, but it will be episodic.
That's what they did with the Lillehammer show. That was,
oh, that's well, right. Yeah, the one.
How about we go a step further with Trion's Defiance? No, what's going to happen with that? Have you seen this? Have you
checked? Yeah, I saw it at E3.
So what do you think?
Well, that's the game that's starting as a TV show and a game at the same time, and that supposedly they will trade off. I don't want to say assets. I will say
an MMO,
plot points, and
a sci-fi
characters.
MMO happening at the same time as a television show,
In
the same universe, where the events of the TV show episode each week would then be shown in the game.
No,
and then,
that's not exactly how it is.
Okay, how does it work?
That's how one might think it would be,
okay, then
but
how
it's
is
actually
it?
Just the same universe.
Okay.
So things are happening, like over here in one corner of the universe is where the TV show takes place.
Uh-huh.
And in the other corner of the universe is where the MMO takes place.
That's
and
not nearly so interesting.
Not nearly so interesting, but it's a hell of a lot more doable.
Yeah, look, I think the issue with that is new IP. I would not be doing new IP both as game and as show. We're at Battlestar Galactica.
Whoa.
And it was still on. You have
even not still
here.
On, I'd do it right now.
I mean, at the very least, I think where sci-fi stumbled is that show should have been on for 2 seasons while they were working on the game. They should have planned this out initially,
but doesn't that feel like, oh, here's a licensed game that's on an established show, rather than we're launching them both at the same time, get on board.
Somehow start teasing the game. I mean, you know, ostensibly there are good marketers out there in media. I have yet to meet a couple, but, you know, I mean, it's just like, you know, it's... You know, sci-fi, I don't think, has the marketing muscle to get that show to really become the most watched, nor does Trion get the game to be so essential either. And you kind of need one of those two to help drive the other. I am not saying the show is bad, nor the game is bad, but how are you going to find that audience?
Well, what I saw at E3, it felt like a very generic MMO so far. Still very early, and maybe the TV show is going to be awesome, but I wasn't impressed.
Paul,
so
do you
far.
Think a cable-quality TV show could have helped Inversion?
Ha ha ha!
Dude, what did you explain the opening cinematic of that
only
game?
Only if you dropped all the DVDs only if you dropped a pallet of DVDs on the game and destroyed it.
Dude, so you're two dude bros chilling in your police car, right? with your tight V-neck shirts on.
I got it right here.
Yeah, you're Ascension, whatever those shirts are, fucking Ed Hardy shirts.
Affliction?
Affliction. I said Ascension.
Wait, isn't that the same thing, or am I that out of the loop with the Utes?
With what?
The Utes. Isn't Affliction and Ed Hardy at least, like, first cousins?
You can wear either of them to a WWE event, you're fine.
Don't diss the WWE. So anyway, so you're driving around, you're two dude bros, you've both been, like, jacking each other's ass with a steroid needle. You're yoked, right? You're having just a normal conversation about banging each other's wives, right? Correct me if I'm wrong on any of this,
I don't know,
Paul.
What you're talking about.
It's the opening cinematic of this game.
I don't remember anything
and,
about
and
steroids.
Let me double check
on
something. The opening cinematic. This is a bad game, correct?
The first part of the game actually is a flash. The whole thing's a flashback. But so the opening cinematic wasn't this. But
it wasn't a flashback.
Well, it's like, yeah, it was the aliens happen.
Basically, it starts off where you're a cop and you're with your partner and you're going home to see, like, your wife and your little kid.
He's talking about having sex with your wife, and they're joking about that.
Well, they're joking about having sex with their wives, but, right? Like, you know, we've all
done
that.
That's better than a serious discussion about having sex with your various
wives.
Well,
exactly. This isn't the 70s.
Right.
And then the ground opens up, these whatever human-like...
Rejects from Borderlands or Fallout come out of the ground,
and then...
And they go to their car. What do they get from their car? Crazy futuristic shotguns that they have for some reason.
Right.
Right? And they start blasting ass.
Yeah.
And then the aliens make the mistake of kidnapping our guys and giving them anti-gravity weapons.
Oh. Right.
Because they want them to move rocks underground.
Of course.
But little did they know, giving them anti-gravity weapons on their backs, they would use them offensively to break out.
Yeah.
They had no way of predicting that.
And they had no way of predicting how bad the camera would be.
So this is kind of like Red Faction meets Dark Void so far. With it's a little bit of bad dudes thrown in.
I kind of thought it might have had like some U-porn angle as well there with the cops, no?
No, I don't. I'm not validating that.
It does gotten better.
Start. I think at the very beginning does start like after the invasion has already happened, and then we flash back to that. No?
No, I thought it starts with them in the car.
I wanted it to start with them in the car. Because it's a
no, that's
a cool
Sonic
premise.
Ad.
It's kind of a cool premise, but it's so ham-fisted and crappy. Because
at some point I just stopped paying attention to the story and just skipped it.
There's so many cutscenes, though.
Yeah.
There's so many cutscenes.
Yeah. Wait, Inversion is cutscene heavy?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's okay.
And there is a whole thing, and at one point I stopped to pay attention, and I was like, wait, how did I want... What?
Oh, see, that's why I'm explaining
this. We will pause right here.
You.
Hold on. Let's pause right here for a moment of Adam's Namco Green Room Theater.
Yeah, okay, so this is from Namco. And Namco, along with Tecmo and a lot of other game developers, they have to okay this premise to go ahead and fund the game.
Now, it's a cool premise. The premise is aliens come and fuck with our gravity.
Okay.
That's a cool premise.
Okay.
They create,
which has already been such a successful model for so many games out there. And given Namco's string of exceptional shooters for the Western market, let's go ahead and add on one of the most challenging things that no one has been able to effectively master in games yet. This is good. This is why I have decided to go and admire Koei for going, let's just make another Dynasty Warriors. All right?
Knowing their limitations.
Yeah, it's kind of like, let's do the gravity... And the dudes with muscles and the aliens, because one of these days we're going to get this right.
I'm not willing to be quite that snarky about it. I think that I think it was an interesting idea that just was handled so poorly.
How many times have we said that about Japanese games?
Six.
I mean, I'm sorry. It's just that's one of the things is, you know, Dead Rising. I mean, yeah, it's true for a lot of.
Although there was the Tecmo shooter that we all forgot very quickly, the one they sent us the can of shoe polish for. Remember the Gears thing that they showed?
I don't have anything sent
to me
anymore.
You're talking about the Gears of War ripoff where you're actually inside like a living building?
Exactly.
Oh, God, that was horrible.
What was that called?
Quantum... I was about to say Quantum Conundrum. But
wait, this is from last year?
Yeah. Remember that thing?
Yeah, Quantum... That game was horrible.
Quantum Theory?
No, that might be
it. The name of a...
No, I think it was Quantum Theory because it was... Yeah. So I remember looking at it, I thought we were doing a flashback episode and we were like, you know, taping PS2 games. Seriously. When I walked in the room and I saw that being played.
Yeah.
Well, the reason I explained that whole beginning of the game is because if they'd handled that like you're an average guy, as we've been saying, as I've been saying about
you're an average guy on steroids with your guy talking about screwing his wife.
If you're an average guy having a real well-written
conversation here in a minute
and aliens show up and fuck with our gravity and you get out of the car and you only have a pistol like an actual cop would have and you're overwhelmed and then they capture you. Now all of a sudden I'm interested. I feel like this is a plausible kind of interesting jumping off point instead of video game world, video game characters, crap. Just
you know what?
Schlock.
I still kind of blame Quentin Tarantino. Because I think so many,
we're gonna need shotguns for this job.
So many people love the beginning of Pulp Fiction and don't get what's so damn good about it.
Well,
it's not.
There's so many people who don't get a lot of what's so good about Pulp Fiction. I mean, a lot of people wallow in the imagery.
Anyway, Paul, go ahead and tell me what you thought of Inversion. Because
I hated it.
Oh, Paul, I'm sorry. Yeah. What's inverted? The controls? The logic?
The world.
It's just because I can float now with my anti-gravity.
It just dawned on me that I'm shooting you a dirty look, and this is on audio only.
Oopsie!
I think they could hear it.
Yeah, I hope so.
You brought a hard stare to a radio show. Yeah. That sounds like Paul Samuel.
Yep.
He's been a knife specialist his whole life.
Well, you know, it was my idea to put the knife guys into Spec Ops. So
really, that's all you're gonna say is you hated it.
It was. I mean, look, the controls were bad. The story was idiotic. The characters were the big thing for me was the gameplay was terrible. Like, I can forgive a game that has a terrible story, especially if you can skip it. Bayonetta is a great example of that. Terrible story told really badly, so I skipped it. It took me 5 hours to play that game, but it was a fun 5 hours. This, though, even when I skipped the story,
numerous cutscenes,
still just really just terrible low rent, you know, controls didn't work the way they were supposed to. Like, trying to shoot things was impossible. The enemies were boring.
There you go, folks. Yeah. Things we've learned already in one half of Weekend Confirmed. Spec Ops, better than Inversion.
Hey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there you go. You can take that to the bank if you stick around and come back. On the other side of this, we will have Quantum Conundrum and other fluffy universe things to talk about. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. All right, so a continuing discussion point that we have sort of hit on here in today's episode of Weekend Confirmed has been this growing difficulty of the burden of living up to expectations, and especially as regards AAA game construction. One of the big pieces of news that came out here right before we went to the studio was the demise of Radical Entertainment as we know it. That would be the studio behind Hulk Ultimate Destruction, Scarface. And yeah, great games, right?
Yeah, I love the game.
And Prototype 1 and 2. Activision released a statement that said that although we made a substantial investment in the Prototype IP, it did not find a broad commercial audience. Imagine that freaky genetic mutation, weird crap going down in New York with an unintelligible protagonist and then another one in the next one with weird viruses. Didn't reach a broad audience. Huh.
Well, weirder stuff has found an audience. Come on.
The first game did quite well. I think it was the second best performing game for Activision. Now, granted, the number one best performing game was a Call of Duty game, and so you're talking about a very, very far second. But yeah, I'm not surprised that Prototype 2 didn't find its audience.
I didn't care for either of those games.
So they've busted up Radical, although apparently it will somehow survive partially in name. They said that some employees will remain working for Radical Entertainment, supporting other existing Activision publishing products. So I guess Radical will now be another Call of Duty support shop.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what happens.
No, hold on.
But the studio will cease development of its own games going forward.
I thought this happened after the first prototype as well.
They were closed down.
I remember that a lot of people were laid off. I know David Holmes, I believe that's – or who's now over at Epic Games, is one of the leads on the game, did leave at that time. That I had actually thought that Radical had been shut down until I started to hear stories about Prototype 2. Hmm. So, I mean, it's – yeah. I feel like I'm having deja vu right here with this announcement.
I don't remember that.
So it begs the question – as Captain Thunderpants asked, and it was interesting, Captain Thunderpants asked this prior to this even happening, are games too big, too pretty, and too expensive? Are large-budget games doomed? And what consequences do you see that having on the market if that market space of games crashes? And it's all part of what we were talking about with, you know, the inability to get good episodic content going around this, and then the ever-growing arms race for how big can the next Call of Duty get and how massive, like, honestly, although I said it jokingly, I wouldn't be surprised if Radical was now going, whoever they keep would be artists and animators kept to work on more Call of Duty stuff, because everybody and their brother is going to pitch in to make Black Ops 2 when it comes down to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think also there were original rumors, because Prototype started in Universal Vivendi, or Vivendi Universal, it really should be. And people thought that they were not going to put that game out, take its engine, and use it for the Spider-Man games. I believe the Amazing Spider-Man game coming from Activision with the movie will be the last of the Spider-Man license for Activision. So
that's the end of Beenox doing those?
I don't know. I mean,
those guys have gotten ground down doing.
Oh that. Yeah, I mean, but you know, they have put out consistent. You know, they have a really good consistent product. But yeah, I don't see where that engine and that tech, especially going into a new generation, is really going to benefit them. So you're probably right. They're going to be a support staff for at least, yeah, Call of Duty. What else do they have?
Well, is somebody else going to
or Skylanders?
Will somebody else get the Spider-Man thing?
Somebody's going to be making Spider-Man.
Well, someone's going to get
Marvel
it, but
Marvel owns the license.
No, do they? I don't think they do. I think Sony does.
Well, Sony has the movie license, but that also is timing out.
Well, it's got to be. I mean, I know the game is tied to the movie license because it's a movie license.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Game.
It's the Amazing Spider-Man. Yeah.
Well, because ultimately all of Marvel's stuff will go through Disney, which I guess means ultimately Spider-Man games will come out through Disney.
That's what I would assume. I mean, I think there's a lot of waiting over Disney for the most important of the Marvel licenses to finally kind of turn out with its relationship with Sony.
This is an anecdotal thing. It may not be true, but what I heard through the grapevine was that Marvel has an entire group of lawyers whose only job is to try to get the Spider-Man license back from Sony.
I mean, look, that thing is... There are very few licenses, Mario and Mickey, it really is in that level, that transcends age. Yeah. Kids love Spider-Man like I did as I was a kid, and adults love Spider-Man.
As an adult.
Exactly. I mean, it really is a remarkable property.
You still have your Spider-Man underoos?
Wearing them.
Oh, that's awesome.
How could I not?
But back to the question.
You haven't grown enough.
You should go. you should go to Carl's Jr. tomorrow, or today, I guess, when this runs. Because apparently if you show up, I think it's Carl's Jr. wearing Spider-Man outfit, but with no mask, they'll give you a free bacon cheeseburger.
So they'll attempt to kill you.
No, really? No. Give them a carrot, because only a six-year-old's going to do that. They don't get... No, you don't know.
Awesome. You really think only a six-year-old is going to show up at Carl's Jr. in a Spider-Man costume?
May I digress and tell you the funniest Spider-Man story ever known to man?
It better live up to that.
Spider-Man 2. I'm with Blair Butler and a lot of my friends. I'm at the Metreon in San Francisco. We're seeing it opening night. And there's this guy who is wearing a Spider-Man outfit from the neck down. Now, from the neck up, it's a dude with a lot of red hair and a bushy beard and glasses. And he is... despite not having the mask, he is playing Spider-Man, and he is running up the stairs and stopping and posing. And it's really kind of funny and odd and a little bit embarrassing. And where I'm standing, there's a large pillar, and I see the guy wearing the Spider-Man outfit come from the right and go behind the pillar, and he doesn't come out the other side. What does come out the other side is a plate load of hot wings flying in that direction. Then, on the right side again, Spider-Man is backing off with his hands up going, sorry, bro, sorry, bro, sorry, bro, as a very, very angry man is staring down at him, much taller. And then Spider-Man gives him a 20 and sheepishly goes into line.
the Spider-Man's nemesis, the Hooters waitress.
I read that book. I think it was Brian Michael Bendis. It was good. Yeah.
That is possibly the best Spider-Man movie story ever.
I mean, you just remember, if you're in the outfit, you're just in the outfit.
You're not Spider-Man.
You are not Spider-Man.
You are not Spider-Man.
And if you go to Carl's Jr., you soon won't fit in the outfit.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably true. So what is the future of big budget games when, you know, there's so many of them to try? And
well, the upside is so big for
the potential upside.
Exactly. And so
much room is there in that competitive space?
Not much, but that's not going to dissuade. I think the thing that we're going to get down to again is this thing we keep coming back to on this show, which is the delta between the Uber AAA and the indie or sort of small bite-sized games is just ever widening and is ever more a no man's land of desperation. Because the upside to those giant big budget things is a huge potential upside. And there's going to be companies that are going to continue to try to swing for the fences that way.
Sure.
And when they do hit and you have all this buzz and you have these crazy first day sales that are, you know, trampling each other, it's going to be worth it for them. It's the games that, they never really caught on. They're sort of just, the IP isn't strong. The idea, you're going to see a lot less risk being taken with big budget. You're going to have the same thing being fed to us over and over. And then everything else is going to be pushed down in that lower tier of, you know, it's 99 cents, it's $2.99, whatever. And those things is where a lot of the creativity lives, but I think there's still going to be people shooting for that high end. And in the next generation, it's going to get even more expensive because we're going to have even higher resolutions. Mm-hmm. And these art assets are going to be even more expensive to produce. And but I don't think that we're going to see those games die out. We're just going to see fewer of them and fewer of them making big risks.
Think about where we are this generation compared to the one before. There were still B titles. Last generation, there really aren't that many. If they are, they're on the Wii, and they're so screaming their B-ness that, you know, it's not even getting covered by us. And I think we're going to cut a little bit more chaff off. Stuff like Inversion
B titles, arguably, at the beginning of this generation.
And I think they learned their lesson very quickly.
Games like Wet.
Yeah, well, that wasn't even the beginning of this generation.
It was middle. Early.
How about games like Gun?
Good, there you go, another one.
You know, there's stuff at the beginning, but, you know, it became more risky, it became more expensive, and yeah, the costs are going to go up, even though it sounds like we're going to look at consoles finally, which all have off-the-shelf parts in them, which is going to keep the cost down somewhat. There has to be the R&D. Look at Watch Dogs, which I am just declaring here, this thing is going to be next-gen.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear.
But
Adam, that's indicative going to be on the current generation.
I believe it's a false quote. I believe that came from somebody who was not authorized to speak in Ubisoft France.
Aha.
Because you're not allowed to speak unless spoken to in Ubisoft.
Exactly. I do not believe that was an official statement from Ubisoft, at least from anybody who is at E3. That, you know, I think they're being a little bit coy.
You don't think it's going to be both?
It'll be like Twilight Princess, right?
I don't think it'd
be. To be fair, I don't think it's a game yet.
No, I mean, yeah. But if what we saw was extrapolated into a game, that's a very expensive game. That's independent animations, independent AI, two things which are going to cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
And in a very, very high degree of player freedom, so you have to really worry about how do I set a boundary to the player that I can control the space they're operating within and not have them feel constrained.
Yeah. No, it's like a warehouse. You can have a bigger warehouse, but it's going to take that much longer to fill it with all of your, you know, stock.
But there's always going to be those guys that want to tout the prettiest, most amazing gee whiz game.
Sure.
and will get rewarded for that because gamers get excited about that kind of thing, myself included.
I mean, I think the strategy was going to happen. I mean, with the, you know, obviously the Infinity Ward lawsuit that didn't make it to court because it was settled, there was that one document about Bungie that came out, and I think it was really fascinating to hear what you had detailed was an IP that had a proper game release every other year, but there was some kind of supplemental release in the inside years, but it also, from what we understand, there's going to be a perpetual nature to it.
Right. Mm.
I think Activision is onto how you make this work, and they're doing it with Call of Duty. I think, and people, look, I'm going to upset people. Call of Duty should eschew the single player, except for maybe every 3 years, and do the multiplayer, but it's subscription based. That's how you make money on stuff like that. And I think you're going to see something of that fashion happening with this Bungie project.
I've been in that camp for months
now.
Yeah.
So what if we are drastically underestimating the potential for the evolution of a designer's tools? Because I look at the mobile space and the indie space and think, well, why are so many things that are interesting happening here? Well, they're happening here because a small shop can do a number of things very well now. You can do them very well.
And very quickly.
And very quickly. And yet we haven't quite broken through that barrier on large scale games, but we got a hint of it with the Unreal Engine 4.
Right. Yes. And absolutely. But I asked Corey Davis that exact thing when he came on the Totally Rad show. And what he was, I mean, we criticize games that look like Unreal Engine games because they seem so cookie cutter. Sure. But part of the reason that some of these developers choose that stuff is because they don't want to worry about it. They can just plug things in and it works, and it works how gamers expect it to work. And then, you know, from his perspective, I'm not putting words in his mouth. He actually, you know, was talking about this. From his perspective, he can concentrate on these other things that he's more interested in.
So
it's a double-edged sword is what I'm trying to say. Okay.
And let me give you the comparison. So the discussion point comes to great art takes time regardless of the production methodology because great art takes a long time to produce.
Right.
Yeah. And my counter to that is a little weird and maybe not completely one-to-one related, but over the years, watching a number of different video producers produce shows that I've been working on, the tool set has advanced to a degree such that things that designers or producers wanted to do in their production workflow to create a show.
Star Wipes.
What?
You can just say it. They've gotten cheaper and easier to put in. Star Wipes.
It blew me out of the water right there. You follow what I'm saying, though? Like, yeah. Those things that we wouldn't have dreamed of being possible. What if something like an Unreal Engine 4 and then maybe the next generation of tool sets continues to make those barriers lower and lower and lower? Because artists, at a point, a guy takes a pencil and he can do incredible creative artwork very, very quickly and efficiently. And there's even like a moment where it's like artists, whatever their platform is, like with this music or whatever it is, sometimes when they're in the zone and cranking stuff out, the faster stuff comes out, the better it is even. If we can get those, if we can get the technical barrier down and we could have them doing those things quickly, what if we're able to get to a point where we could have a more quote-unquote frictionless production pipeline for making big games?
The unfortunate byproduct of that is a homogenous-looking end result.
But what if it's not? What if it's homogenous because we've achieved such a high fidelity plane that it doesn't matter anymore? I mean, goddamn it, I sound like Dennis Dyack now, but like,
what
if we hit that point?
Well, I think that a similar argument could be made. Why can't anyone put something out on the market that competes with the Unreal Engine? I'm not saying there's something fundamentally flawed with the Unreal Engine.
Well, CryEngine 3 is getting there.
Yeah, but they're not licensing it. All these good engines. They are outside of EA.
Well, Hawkins on it.
You're right.
And
all right, I stand corrected on that. All right, good.
So yeah, they are. Their aim is to make it out there. Now, of course, their tool set is not. I mean, I think that's the thing you're seeing.
Is a little bit German, you say?
The thing you see in Unreal Engine 4 and the thing that Epic had become masters of. So first they had a great engine, and then they put in a great support staff so that if you were making whatever your John Woo action flick was based on Unreal Engine, you could call up somebody and go, holy shit, I can't get this thing working. I need some help. And they'd throw a couple engineers at it. And now instead of throwing a couple engineers at it, they've taken it to the next step, which is their actual tool set works better and you're able to use their engine at a higher level.
And the one thing which is really admirable and has always been, I think, a cornerstone probably since Unreal Engine 2 is...
Jeff is getting us drunk.
Jeffrey!
Not my fault.
It's the fact that it's a very economical engine. It's based upon not having... I mean, everything wants to look good, but it's not doing it at such a cost of the memory that you're going to have the rest of your game suffer.
I get it.
And they seem to be so much more focused on that than a lot of engines out there. Obviously, when they were competing against id, it is incredibly shiny surfaces, and we can have three enemies on screen. Yeah. You know, that's what Doom 3 turned into.
Yeah.
It is kind of funny how much And then this is, I'm sorry, folks, if you are bored by this, I apologize. We will get back to games for sure in the next segment. But now I'm going to like move into another part of, like, we're almost into like GDC talk territory. Do you remember a couple, 3 years ago where the Final Fantasy team was sitting at GDC and explaining about how long they had worked to develop the tool set so that they could actually create the next generation of Final Fantasies? And they were just getting to the point where they could do a design work and actually implement it and see what they were working on right away.
Yeah. And it's, we like, got, what, two games out of that?
Hey, 13.2 is pretty good. And my point that I'm coming to this out of is that, to wind this back a bit, the point that I wanted to make out of this is that as we increase this arms race, as you increasingly push things out further and further and further and make it higher and higher and higher and harder and harder and harder to make the big game that's going to be awesome, how do you ever live up to that potential? It's the same question that Wada was trying to address in talking about Final Fantasy VII Remake, which people have been wanting this for a long time. And he said, hey, we can't make a Final Fantasy VII Remake right now, because if we did so, the franchise would be over. And I thought about it for a minute, and I said, actually, I get that, because what he's saying is that if we've never made a better Final Fantasy than Final Fantasy VII, and we go back and remake it, it's basically an admission
it's going to point, yeah.
It's an admission of, that by the way, that was the best thing we ever did, and yeah, we can't really do that ever again.
No, I think it's an interesting point. I mean, I think also games are so much more corporate now. You know, you can't move without getting clearances from a lot of management that's above you. I mean, I go back to just the way I functioned in this industry when I first started out. I'll get on the phone and be like, hey, can I get some footage of your game? Sure thing. There's no way I can do that now.
That's because
it's
so much
more
money.
Now it's like, hold on, we got to check with Europe. Oh, I don't know. How are you going to be showing
it? You also don't have a job.
Oh, that's why I can't get footage these days.
Yeah, they're not just going to send you footage because they like you.
They will send him builds, though.
You know what? They just might, because where is it going to go? You know, I can't get IGN's nose bent out of joint because I got the exclusive with no website to host it on.
Yeah. I like it.
Adam's new website, comeovertomyhouse.com.
Got the new video up. It's in my living room.
Is that registered yet?
It is now.
I need to check right now. Come over to myhouse.com. Adam's already written it down. Folks,
that
it's
like
already
a porn
gone.
Site.
It sounds like a porn site. Well, we have completed the trifecta now. Guns, booze, and porn.
Well,
so we're talking about Lollipop Chainsaw now?
The thing we left out of this discussion, talking about the high end, is that at the same time, while games have never been more corporate, they've also never been more accessible to just have something out on a platform that millions of people have in their pocket.
And that's the thing is, it is increasingly disconcerting to me, the myopia that I think that the established publishers are having with regards to mobile. It is going to eat their lunch.
Why do you think myopia? Because obviously most of these publishers have made forays into the mobile space.
Yeah, but how many of them were at E3?
How much mobile stuff did you see at
E3?
Gameloft was in a closet. Right. Call
it a loft.
Sorry.
On the ground. I mean, I do think it's myopic because there's this assumed value in the AAA title. And for all four of us sitting here, that is true. And I think the echo chamber of like our relationship, that's our connection to the press or to the outside world a lot. It's like talking to us, and we're kind of on board with them. We like our AAA games.
Yeah.
The majority of people don't feel like spending that kind of money. They have this device with them, and they look at games more as a distraction. You know, and I think that we're not looking at that ecosystem that's really out there, and it could really start to tear away, because for those casual players or casual-ish, if they're getting that kind of fun of interactivity from playing Spell Tower or something like that on their iPad, they're not feeling that there's something lacking because they're not going home and playing Call of Duty at night.
Mm-hmm. See, but I think actually there's something there, because like you look at what Epic are doing right now. They just said something about how they made more money off of the iPad.
Infinity Blade.
Now, I don't know if they meant that in terms of like percentage-wise or total cash or whatever.
Well, they probably own it outright, so there's a good reason why they may have made that.
But what I'm kind of wondering is maybe that's the model that you will see going forward, sort of the opposite of the publishing industry, where in book publishing, you do a Stephen King book because you know it's going to make a ton of money, and that's what let you put out like the little Charles Simic poetry book. And I wonder if you're going to see the reverse in gaming, where you put out a bunch of iPad games that make a ton of money, that are quick and easy and dirty, and it lets you fund that big project you want to do, which, if it pays off, you've got, you know, your money and your toys and your all the other stuff.
I mean, I think there's a valid point there, but I fear that, say, Steven Spielberg, he does Jurassic Park 2, and we get Munich out of it.
Right. Yeah.
But there's only so many people with that kind of pull of Steven Spielberg. I could see, like, well, just keep on giving us those mobile games that make us money, and that, you know, are we really going to get that AAA game? But I think that dynamic is coming.
I also think more and more of those mobile games are a lottery ticket as well, and they're going to come up. You know, they're going to come up winning far less frequently because there's just so many of them.
The curation, I mean, whoever figures out how to actually curate the games that are available and make them apparent to, you know, the average consumer, they win.
Yeah.
Because, you know, obviously Apple is not doing a fine job of that because we all know that it's a little rigged when you go to that app store. But, I mean, yeah, that's where the trick is. And, hey, I was going to let everyone know, I'm going to Australia. And the last time I did a long trip, I just crowdsourced on Twitter, like, what I should get and put on my iPad. I'm going to be doing the same thing again because I have no idea what's out there.
We should talk.
Oh, good.
Well, obviously, folks, you all know that I'm now in the mobile game. I'm now in the mobile game publishing
business. Very good point.
So as a mobile game publisher, I could certainly point you to a number of titles that you would.
Do you play Magic the Gathering, Adam?
No.
Dude, Duos of the Planeswalkers is great on the iPad.
I know. And it's private and solo and no one will know.
Yeah, you'll never have to admit it.
I will know.
You will know. So, you know, we glazed past it very quickly, the Final Fantasy VII thing, which I thought was very interesting because I compare Final Fantasy VII on the PlayStation to Call of Duty in the modern era. And I wonder, for you guys, so first of all, are there any of you that really don't like Call of Duty games? I mean, just have like an aversion to them. So do you have like a favorite one? Like, what was your favorite Call of Duty?
Probably the first Modern Warfare.
The first Modern Warfare. What was your favorite Call of Duty?
Maybe second Modern Warfare.
Trying to decide between Call of Duty 2.
That's a good one, too.
Or Modern Warfare 1. Modern Warfare 1 blew my socks off the most. You know, and I still think it had the strongest single player of the bunch.
So I'm a Call of Duty 2 as my favorite one.
Okay, the one that is World War II.
World War II,
yeah,
right.
Xbox 360 launch title.
And because it felt like they were still in that mode of really good per adventure node sandbox mechanic. Mm-hmm. So they took you node to node to node in a linear manner, but when they got you to a node, there was still some, you know, good flank and maneuver and tacticality to it as opposed to what they've come to now, which is very much like very scripted, guided experience. And that's fine. They're both interesting. Anyway, my point is that Final Fantasy VII, it does feel like, as the creator said, you know, look, we've always been trying to live back up to Final Fantasy VII. We've never achieved it. Whereas with Call of Duty, each one sort of has its own...
There isn't a distinct best Call of Duty game.
Yeah, there's not a distinct best Call of Duty.
They're also not as different from one another, I would venture, as the Final Fantasies are from one another. Final
Fantasies are pretty different from each other.
They have distinct fighting engines. They have distinct, I mean, storylines and settings. They have a whole distinct style palettes.
But also, I mean, I'm of the camp. Look, I'm not a lover of Final Fantasy VII. I think it cast a shadow over game development that did not benefit most other games
for
in
sure.
Way.
And people took the wrong things away from it.
Yeah, but also, I think this obsession, this desire for a remake of Final Fantasy VII is like a lot of grown adults trying to relive their first kiss. It happened. It's in the past. You move on because it's not going to be good if somehow you can get back there and do it again. You know, it is an old game with old mechanics and I think some culturally dubious stereotypes embedded in it.
You're talking about my first kiss?
Yeah. And the thing is, I don't know if you want to recapture that. Let it live in your memory as a wonderful experience. But I think when brought into the light of day, I think that we see that there's a lot more that's limiting to that game than we actually realize. And I think when the closer corollaries is everyone thinking Conker's Bad Fur Day was funny and discovering it actually wasn't when they played it on the Xbox.
I've forgotten that one. I think actually I knew at the time it really was that. Yeah.
It was just the audacity of seeing.
We sort
poop
of liked the audacity
and
conking too.
I mean, yeah,
I don't know if I had anything to add to that. That was well done, sir. You may have the floor.
Well, I'm just, look, this is what happens during employment. I sit around in my underwear without pants and get angry about things I forgot to say when I had a TV show.
So you know what I'm excited about is that this week I've been sitting there camping on Camel 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 for Max Payne 3 because I wanted to pick it up. I didn't want to pay $60 for it. I was like, I mean, that I admit it, that's lame, right? So I got it, hit 40, I bought it, and I'm excited to play it.
Could have just given you my copy, bro. Yep.
But I want the code so I can play online because multiplayer has been well received. Adam, you said that you love the game, but I love this point you made about it, that it has interesting mistakes.
Yeah, it has very interesting mistakes. I went to the trouble. I didn't have the game. I was traveling to New York when the game was coming out. And it was Diablo 3 that came out the same time.
Yes.
So here I am unemployed, and I managed to travel right when the two great reasons to be unemployed come out. So, of course, I'm in New York. I'm like, hey, Rockstar. I'm outside. Can I have a copy?
Geronimo comes down and he's like, here, yeah. Bud.
And, I got back home and I played it, and there's so many things that I love. I love the way it looks. I find the favela scene, just the way the color just separates in that, it's just like, I haven't seen anything like that. And when the game is on fire and it plays like a classic Max Payne, it's really, really satisfying. I do wonder why they put the cover system in there, because it's like they don't instruct the player to understand when to cover and when to become incredibly aggressive. And each set piece seems to favor one over the other. And there's not a good semiology to kind of tip you off. And, you know, I always felt like I was playing it poorly when I was in cover shooting guys. Like, I want to just jump towards your face. And sometimes when I was dying in cover and suddenly I was like doing something crazy because there's all these armed guys, but I'm just shooting him right in the face. I couldn't believe that that was actually the right way to play it and was just so sexy.
Or how many levels would the cutscene ends and they throw you in the center of the room and there's 14 guys around you and it's like,
they had,
is it slow-mo time? Is that what I'm supposed to do?
I think had they had a slower tutorial, kind of like, you know how the last Splinter Cell game, like, it probably was at its best in the tutorial because you felt the dynamic range of what the game was supposed to offer. If they had a tutorial like that that really kind of got you to experiment, and granted, it's Rockstar. I don't know how you fit that into the narrative, but
I don't know if this applies. The things that I loved about Max Payne, especially the first one versus, say, a Fear, was how Max Payne really very quickly you learned that this game wants me to use slow-mo the moment I have that bar filled back up to stab it again and use it again to be ridiculous.
Which is true in this
one. I love that.
You can abuse the hell out of the slow-mo and the game is still hard.
That's awesome. That's what I want.
But then sometimes it just punishes you and you're like, what did I do?
I don't want punishment.
There is some of that.
Life is punishment.
Life is punishment. We can confirm it is never punishment. It's always a good time. If you stick around when we come back on the other side, we still have some other stuff to get to. I'm going to let these guys tell me in the break what they want to hit before we close this sucker out on the other side of this break.
Super Mega Worm. And it's fun to say Super Mega Worm.
It is sort of
Super Mega Worm.
Fun to say Super Mega Worm.
Super Mega Worm. Super Mega Worm.
What do I do as a Super Mega Worm?
You eat people.
Super Mega Worm.
Blow up planes and spaceships and shit.
Super Mega Worm.
Super Mega Worm.
Super Mega Worm.
Super Mega Worm.
You eat people.
Super Mega Worm. Blow up planes and spaceships and shit. And it's fun to say
Super Mega Worm.
It is sort of
Super Mega Worm.
Fun to say Super Mega Worm.
Super Mega Worm. It's just, there's women pushing babies and like people will get scared and run and they'll say things like, I just bought a new car.
Super Mega Worm.
Super Mega Worm doesn't care about your car.
Super Mega Worm. Take my wife instead.
Super Mega Worm.
They care about your baby.
Super Mega Worm. Super Mega Worm. And it's fun to say
Super Mega Worm.
Super Mega Worm.
Oh no way.
Super Mega Worm.
In space.
Super Mega Worm.
Oh no way.
Super Mega Worm.
In space.
Super Mega Worm.
It is sort of
Super Mega Worm.
Fun to say Super Mega Worm.
That's a blast from the past.
That's how you know this is a monster episode, is you get Super Mega Worm. All right,
did you see that Brian is back to posting on Gaff?
Yes.
Yes. I was very happy to see that.
And by the way, empathy.
Yeah.
Love to have you on, dude. You know
he's awesome.
Del Rio, I think he's like a daily, like a regular day job. But if you can get some time off, dude, chair is right there. It's sitting there begging for you to come on. And
I think it's begging for something, but it's because people are sitting on it. I don't know. That didn't even make any sense.
It's begging for me to get off. It's like, I hate this butt. I don't like it. It makes me sad.
So you ventured into Kim Swift's new puzzle chamber world, Quantum Conundrum.
Yeah, I'm sure you guys all played it at various events, and it is just as charming and fun as you would have expected it to be. I mean, it's Portal. It really is Portal.
No, it's not Portal. There's no portals. You're not shooting any portals.
It's kind of portally. I mean,
really?
it scratches the same itch of I'm going from room to room. There's a charming, hilarious voiceover guiding me through the adventure. It's a circular door that I have to figure out a way to open by manipulating the universe in certain ways. It scratches the same itch. Nothing wrong with that.
So there's some familiarity.
Great itch to scratch. Yeah.
But instead of opening portals, you're changing physics.
Right. But the lateral thinking and the sort of puzzle solving elements are very similar.
In a good way, or in I've done this before way?
In a good way. I mean, there aren't that many games like that. It doesn't feel like an original, wholly original experience.
Really?
To me. Hmm. And I also, you know, I haven't finished it yet. I'm planning to do that tonight. But I have yet to really feel super stuck. I feel I've been kind
of
breezing through.
Do you want to feel super stuck?
Well, there's a wonderful moment in the portals where you just sit there and you're crunching on it and you trying certain things and it just feels like this is impossible. And then you do that one thing where it's like, oh, I'm a genius.
Now is it as fungible as Portal is, where you
can
really kind of experiment with things, or is it like you either are on the right path or you're just going to stand there?
Yes, it's the latter.
That sounds like more of the problem, especially in Portal 2. I could sometimes probably not do exactly what they intended and find some weird way to still get to where they wanted me to be.
Yeah,
or even if you didn't get there, there were like funny, fun things that happened because you're like, what if I put a portal over here and go through over here and then I'll come out there, and while I'm coming out there, I'll shoot a portal there.
Yeah,
there's a little of that.
You create your own game for yourself,
like, right?
Can I pull it off?
There's a little of that, but it's not anywhere near as much, and that's because you have fewer options at any given time. And
but
really,
there's more old school mechanics to it, right?
What do you mean by old school mechanics?
Because some of the stuff that I played in later levels during demos was lots of what I used to think of like hardcore platformy type mechanics, like I would have seen in like a good,
much more platforming,
good
yes.
Crash Bandicoot. Of lots of three-dimensional space stuff and having items moving one direction, but then reversing them and getting them moving another direction or changing the way that they operate within the space.
That's
and hopping from
true.
One to another. And so if you're into that, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
As long as it's not Zine.
I think it's a very worthwhile experience. I'm only playing on the PC so far. It's only $15.
It's only on PC right now.
Right, yeah.
Temporary.
But it will be on XBLA.
It's a Steam Steam timed exclusive.
Well, that was nice of them.
Nice. Yes, I'm sure that was. They're very friendly. They're like, oh, would you like to make this a Steam timed exclusive? Oh, yeah, sure. Okay, great. Handshake, coffee?
And Q is the guy telling you where to go, so that's fun. You know, Q from Next Generation.
I remember him.
Yeah. Oh, not Q from James Bond.
No, not that.
No, John DeLancey.
What was the original Q, who actually made it through almost all the movies?
He passed away.
Right.
Dennis Llewellyn?
I think that's it. I want to say there's a Mulroney in there, but probably not.
Now it's John Cleese.
I don't know.
Yeah, now it's John Cleese.
He wasn't even in the last couple.
Well, that's right. There was no cue at all. They left that off the keyboard.
And so how do you go from Fluffy Realm to Inferno?
Alt-Tab. Because Diablo's always on! It's always on.
And how's your Diablo campaign? We had to like give Jeff a moment. He told me, I got to have a moment for my Diablo 3 minute.
So good.
I'm going to give you something here that I actually thought was a really interesting conversation thread that came up within the Shack News thread over this between Kyrie and Tyrdome about
Tyrie. Oh, I thought it was like the Mr. song.
I actually interpreted it like the Mr. song.
I bet that's in Paul's head right now.
Yes, it is.
Ha ha ha.
Score.
Dun, dun, dun. Anyway, so they basically were talking about the way the itemization within the game is not set properly for playing the game within only the context of the levels, but demands that you use the auction house because the gear that you find is always one tier under the gear level that you would need to be successful where you are. to explain that. The viability of untwinked solo play is greatly reduced compared to Diablo 2. Gear that could be considered good for your level simply doesn't drop until you progress past the point where that gear would be useful. So, for example, in Act 3 of Hell, I might find a weapon that's great for a character in Act 4 Nightmare and is way better than anything that would have dropped to me in Act 4 Nightmare. In Diablo 2, the best gear would always drop to me in the zones that would be around good for that level.
That is not wrong. Not wrong.
That's bullshit!
And also, it's compounded now since the 1.0.3
And I'm sorry
patch.
To like, explain, like that's messed up.
Well, it's compounded now because now you see item level.
Right.
And so a lot of stuff that could have been viewed as more valuable than it was, now it's like, oh, but it's only a level 61. I'm not buying that. So the whole economy has kind of been thrown into whack for me. It's problematic.
Look, the economy of Diablo 3 sounds like it's rivaling Spain's.
Well, that's like, not too big of an accomplishment at this point.
Yeah, but then who's Germany in all of this to kind of get it under control?
Yeah.
I'm trying.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. I'm a little surprised. You know, we were there when they announced the auction house.
We were.
And there was a lot of just eyebrow raising.
I railed against it and was immediately indicted for railing against it.
But I guess I had assumed if they were going to go down that path, they knew what they were getting themselves into. And what has happened is a little bit surprising that, you know, it
so as we sat there, do you, I mean,
I showed up a little bit late, so.
Well, I want to try and not look like a jackass about this.
Too late.
I think my whole point was I didn't have that confidence because they didn't say anything that expressed to me that they had a concept of the gravity of the economy that they were creating. It's like we understand that people have been out there farming gold in Diablo 2 and World of Warcraft, and we want to take advantage of it. So we're going to do some stuff and take advantage of it.
I think, Garnet, I think unfortunately, at least from my perspective, your opinion on this got conflated with the real money auction house rather than it, because
yes,
I've
it
come
did.
To realize that you had an issue with the concept of the auction house at all.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people, myself included, really conflated that with some sort of negativity about real money.
Everything
being
was eclipsed by the real much like
exactly.
by the real money auction house. That was just a shock.
Because it was just a huge piece of news.
Real money was the top tier, like way over the line part of it. Because now it's like not only are you adding an auction house, which like changes the whole itemization structure of the game, but you're doing it to where I can just go buy shit.
But that adds a whole stream of issues that I don't think we even need to talk about right now, because I think the real thing that has come to pass, unfortunately, is that the auction house in and of itself has fundamentally changed the game.
Because they pulled the design from World of Warcraft, basically, which is that you're going to drive your itemization based off of going into the game, adventuring, pulling stuff out of adventuring as if you are mining it and then pulling it into a mining market and then exchanging your ore for someone else's refined ore that fits what you want to do.
I just don't understand. I would love to sit in a meeting as a fly on the wall and understand what the long-term design sensibility is of this. How the sustainability of this seems completely doomed. I don't understand how you can continue.
I assume this is fetid ground for whatever the next MMO is. I mean, I feel there's something too experimental here. To Garnet's point, there was that sense that they introduced the shocking concept of the real money auction house, which would have probably been just a shock if they just said auction house, and they didn't have a full explanation. They were cagey about it, and at that time, it was relatively close to when we thought the game was going to be launching.
Yeah,
and it did seem. Well, I want to put some blame on Blizzard for this, but something felt external. It felt like that they were suddenly not able to stand in front of something and really explain.
I just don't know they had it thought out. I mean, it seems like so many things are in flux. Number one, when I sat down, and I'll say this again, when I'm playing this game, although I enjoy great bits of it, I don't completely understand why it took them so long to make Diablo 2.5, Diablo 3. And there are things they learned from WoW, there are things they took from WoW, and there are pieces of art and all that sort of stuff. But they've been on this game for years upon years upon years. So fits and starts. Our friend Shacker Warcrow, who is named Mark, and he does this little site, and he did an interview with, I'm trying to remember which one of the guys he interviewed, but anyway, Mark interviewed this guy who had worked on Diablo 3, I wish I could remember, it was one of the designer guys, and said that, well, you know, he actually admitted Diablo 3 was going to be an MMO, and they were developing it as an MMO which I think is where maybe part of this stuff holdovers from.
I don't know. It's possible.
I mean, it certainly seems that way.
I mean, it is an MMO if the first M stands for
minimum. Yeah, it's money. In a weird crossover space, but it's not in a good... I think it's like different hybrid adaptations of that, and Guild Wars and Guild War 2, much better adaptation of it in the way that they address being multiplayer online.
Well, let's not go too far here. I mean, you can indict the auction house, and it is problematic, but the multiplayer elements of this game are absolutely incredible.
I agree with Jeff on this one.
It is so seamless and perfect, and it works exactly how I would want it to work all the time. All the time.
So doesn't it frustrate you that the way you get gear is by basically mining stuff and farming it and bringing it back to the auction house and managing the auction house?
Well, it's worse than that, because the way I get gear at this point is I farm it, and I don't get anything. I don't get anything that I can sell.
But that's not fun.
It's gotten to the point now where I'm farming Act 1 of Inferno and just the tiniest bit of Act 2, up to Magda, basically, of Act 2 of Inferno. And the chance that we can get something that is either usable or sellable is extraordinarily low.
Is that fun?
It has become less fun. The game itself is still really fun for some reason. I can't explain why.
Now,
I'm still enjoying it.
I'm curious, who out there is still playing the game like a game? Because, I mean, that's actually what I've been doing. And
I'm
when
only
I started
playing
out,
it as a game.
And I was just playing it single player, and I was getting really cool loot drops.
Well, the problem
I always
is,
felt I was getting that one thing that put me like 2-3 levels ahead of where I should have been, and that was the perfect lure to keep me playing the game, because I want to see how many enemies I can hack through that much faster.
No, that's a blast up through the first two difficulty levels of the game.
Right.
And the problem goes to hell.
Yes, figuratively and literally. But it also is... The problem for me is that I really have no desire to start a new character class, which is, I think, the next thing for me to do. Other than that, I don't have anything to do.
So do you think maybe you're being punished for your obsessiveness?
Well, I don't know about punished, but I'm certainly...
Exploited.
There's nothing at the
Exploited
end of this rainbow.
For your obsessiveness.
I got to the end of the rainbow, and there wasn't anything there. There's just not. It's nothing there. There's no there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a treadmill, and then I got to the end of the treadmill, and I'm like, oh, awesome, at the end of the I can keep treadmilling, you know, and that's not necessarily their fault, because I got 100 hours of entertainment out of this game, of very high quality entertainment.
Do you really
with
have
my
100
friends.
Hours?
I'm over, well over 100 hours,
dude. So this is a very high value problem.
But the problem, exactly, it's champagne
problem. This game's been out a month, right?
You have 100,
well over 100. Yes, yes. I have 100 on one character, and I have multiple characters. So, and I will
okay,
say that's with
if
my
you
friends.
Were a person and you were 100 years old. You would be dissatisfied with things, too. You're like, oh, I got to get up and poop and eat. And
so that's the
bed.
Exchange rate is hour for year.
Poop and eat and go to bed. I mean, it's kind of like mining, but in kind of a retrograde manner.
The loot is shitty when you're 100, too.
Tell me about it.
You've given up hopes.
No, but I mean, I want to emphasize that that is fun I've had with my friends in a wonderfully seamless great online game that is extremely fun all the way through.
Let me ask you another question. What do you think the chances are that you'll play Torchlight 2 for 100 hours?
That is a very good question. Low. And I don't know what that secret sauce is. It
really?
Might come down to simply being an art style that isn't as evocative for me.
Yeah, I think it's the speed of the attacks. There's something, and if you're telling me they spent 2 years figuring out what the cause and effect ratio was supposed to be in that game, because that's where the sexy comes in.
Yeah,
where it's like, oh god, I can't just do that one more time. Yeah. And there's not even feedback coming through my mouse, and it's funny, but there's some loop I find myself stuck in when I'm playing Diablo that, you know, I cannot just tear myself away unless I really have to pee.
And even then, sometimes
then
I'm just
gonna
go on a limb,
and it was fine.
I'm gonna go on a limb, since you guys both like Diablo that much, and bet that one of the two of you will be equally as hooked on Torchlight 2. Because having played it a significant amount, I think that it's a superior game.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it is, but I just play Diablo.
From an addictive standpoint, even. I think even from an addictive standpoint, that it is more...
Okay, if I pick it up in 2 months, because I have the memory of doing those actions that are so fresh in my mind. Like,
yep.
That's kind of why I went to Spec Ops and why I went to Max Payne
3.
It's kind of like, I need something a little...
Yeah.
A little more evolutionary.
It's so sad because we had so many years when there weren't any games like that.
Right.
And now.
But I think it's like crack. You smoke it all at once and you're like, I'm never going to smoke crack again. You right. know, where, you know, maybe spec ups is more like whiskey. It's like, oh, man, drinking that entire bottle in 3 days probably wasn't the best. I'll get one the day after next.
Wow.
Is that how it is? Then you create Lollipop Chainsaw and there's cheerleaders running around with chainsaws and disembodied heads.
And fun? I haven't played it. Remember, I'm unemployed, so I'm not always running down to the store.
Corey liked it last week, and Paul seems. What do you think?
I had fun with it. I mean, it was very short. It was very quick.
That's good.
It's
in a way
very button mashing-y, and it's got some very funny bits. And for the 5 or 6 or 7 hours it took me one weekend to play it, it was fine. I don't have any interest in playing it a second time. I don't. They never make a sequel. I'm not going to be that upset.
Compared to Shadows of the Damned, which I thought was just kind of
way
a
better.
It's okay, good. Shadows
Way
of the Damned.
I did not like Shadows of the Damned at all.
I liked Shadows of the Damned a lot.
Oh. It was like the worst parts of Resident Evil.
Yeah, I know. I didn't like the mechanics at all, but I had so much fun with the game.
Yeah, but also just like the puzzle structure. It's
like,
why was I supposed to figure that out?
It was ridiculous.
This is much more mindless. I mean, this is literally like you're either hitting the guy with a chainsaw or you're doing some cheerleader move that sort of stuns him and then you hit him with a chainsaw. And, you know.
That's considered variance in modern video
games.
Every
once in a while, Michael Rosenbaum makes some funny joke, and she shows her panties, and that's the end of it.
Sounds like a success. A big win.
It's in a weird way, it's sort of the Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter of video games. Like, if you walk into that expecting anything more than what it is, you're going to be disappointed, and you're probably a bit of a fool.
If you have standards.
Ben Fritz walked out. Ben Fritz said he walked out.
I know he walked out. And the funny thing to me is I have a great deal of respect for that guy, but
I know.
How do you walk into that movie not knowing what you're getting into to the point where you walk out?
I saw it and was a little shocked at some things. The fact that if they had added a little more history into it, the
or
joke would have been so much better. Literally,
a vampire says, we are all slaves to something.
But see,
that's what I checked out on.
I like how it was serious, but Frederick, not Frederick Douglass. Stephen Douglas.
Buster Douglas.
Yes, Buster Douglas. Stephen Douglas shows up, and you're like, oh, how is he going to work into the story? He doesn't. Yeah. And, you know, but think about it. What if, like, you know, John Brown's attack on Harper's Ferry in a vampire motif could become very interesting. I did want to invoke Frederick Douglass because what if, by the end of it, it's just Lincoln and Frederick Douglass just slaughtering people?
But Harriet Tubman's there. For some reason,
actually expected there to be even less history than there was,
and they work in his child dying in the White House.
That is just not fair. That is a man in a hat,
right? But that's exactly what I thought it was going to. That's what it was.
If I want a man in a hat hurting people, I'll watch The French Connection.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So before we wrap this thing to finishing moves, I'm going to throw this around the table real quick. What's your take on the 3DS XL?
I want one. Is that bad?
No, not at all.
I want one.
Okay. Jeff Cannata wants one. Paul Semmel?
I might want one if there's actually a game on it that I'd want to play, and there isn't, and I don't know why there isn't the other thumbstick, because the only game on that system I want to play is the Resident Evil one.
They have announced the 3DS XL extra stick for Japan.
I know, but I don't want to have to buy something extra, and I shouldn't have to buy something extra just to play one game.
It will run on 2 AA's and 1 AAA and a CR2032 battery. And yes. It'll be available
and
with your favorite.
And a mouse running in a wheel, and yeah, whatever.
Adam?
As with most of the supersized fast food menus, a bad idea made bigger is just a bigger bad idea. No, this is, I mean, yeah. You need 5 good games before you get to try to shove down the big version of this piece of dookie. Really. Nintendo needs to pack up their handheld market, go home, and think about the mistakes they made. That's what I have to say.
God.
And then Reggie's sitting around trying to say, oh, core gamers are asking too much. Quality. We're asking for quality on a vaguely regular basis and clarity. Clarity, which is also lacking from Nintendo.
Wait. I don't think that. All he said was, one of the things that on the one hand I love and on the other hand that troubles me tremendously about not only our fan base but about the gaming community at large is that whenever you share information, the perspective is, thank you, but I want more.
No.
Thank you, but give me more. I mean, it's insatiable.
They had a press conference. This is a means by which they manipulate us in the press to convey their marketing message to a wider audience. Their marketing message was muddled, unclear, juvenile, and completely uninteresting. And then they're trying to blame us as the messenger for somehow, you know, because we wanted more.
23 games.
I wanted less of stuff I liked rather than just like Pikmin and then blah. So
also, like, what would you really? I mean, like, it's kind of a weird statement to make because it's like, do you really want to be like, yeah, this is what we're doing, and have everybody go, no, okay.
Yeah.
Right. Do you know what I mean?
Like, we want exactly the amount you're giving us.
Yeah. Well,
exactly
even,
the amount. We are satiated.
Right. You want people to still. I mean, I understand.
You mean leave them wanting more?
Yeah.
All right, we'll do that right now as we hit it with finishing news.
Oh, yeah, walked right into that one.
Finishing moves.
All right, sir, you may kick us off there, Mr. Paul Semmel.
Well, the thing I wanted to talk about a little real quick is we sort of talked about the Hearts of Darkness, which is the book that is a big influence on Spec Ops. And we also talked about the fact that how some people feel the story is not satisfying. And I wanted to basically say, if you found the story in that game not satisfying, maybe go out and find a different means to satisfy those needs. For example, a book or a movie. Like we talked about, bunch of movies you could watch. There's a lot of great books about war. There's a book called Matterhorn by Carl Marlantis that I read last year that was really fantastic. The Naked and the Dead by
Norman Mailer,
which I just read finally, which is amazing. Because I find personally that if you have a well-balanced entertainment diet that includes other things, that you will appreciate certain things in games more. Dude. And by the same token, you will appreciate things in movies and things
maybe,
like that.
Maybe my favorite finishing move ever, right?
Yeah,
there.
he kind of won finishing moves there.
Well done.
And I can figure this out. If you want to know some books to read, I talk about books all the time.
That
I
am.
No. I was going to say, you follow me on Twitter at Paul Semmel, which is PAULSEMEL, no spaces, no whatever, because I sometimes talk about books that I've read on there that I'm reading, what I've just read, and I try to be well-rounded and don't always do it, but I try.
Excellent. Good one. That's how you do it, folks, right there. Adam Sessler?
I love the fact that I'm now flustered trying to follow Paul Semmel, who's talking about books. Yeah, mine is far more self-indulgent. I do apologize for that. The number one thing people keep on asking me is, Adam, where are you going? I don't know, but I will go somewhere, and when I get there, I will make sure you and your mom know. Please do not worry. I'm taking the first time off I've had in my life in 16 years. I like you all, but it's quiet time.
Will you still come here?
I will come here no matter where I am.
There you go.
See? Awesome.
Jeff Cannata.
I am going to be greedy and do two quick hits because there's two games that I have somehow managed to not get in the show 2 weeks in a row now. The first one being Gravity Rush, which I've been playing on my Vita. Yes, the Vita has a great game, and it's called Gravity Rush. Fantastic traversal, really wonderful. Yes, it could work on the PS3. It would be great on the PS3, but it also works great on the Vita. It has awesome integration with touchscreen controls, and I really, really like it. It's beautiful and charming and fun. And the second game is Civilization V: Gods and Kings, which all you need to know to make you want to run out and buy it. Yes, the game adds a lot of new stuff, but chief among those things is there's a new scenario that's a total conversion that turns Civ into steampunk Civ. It's rad. It's full on a steampunk total conversion.
And thus Jeff
graphics,
was completely enamored.
New graphics, new storyline, like new technologies, like Tesla coils and cool shit. It's super awesome. So
awesome,
digging it.
All right, my quick follow-up is thank you very much to those of you who have already donated $130 towards my little brother's ride for the Colorado Children's Hospitals. I will post that again in this week's show thread. That puts him a little bit over 10% of the way to his goal to $1,000. Much, much appreciated. But bigger problem is that both he and my mom live in Colorado Springs, and if you have not been following us, they have a terrible wildfire raging
that
there.
That photo you posted was insane.
So that actually was, he didn't actually take that, but he has some other ones that are equally bad that he took. The fire line was about 4 miles from my mom's house. But regardless, and it turns out after a little more looking, this is turning out to be a very, very bad fire season for the southwestern United States. So, you know, if the Children's Hospital of Colorado doesn't strike your fancy, the American Red Cross will be needing to help a number of families as they try to cope with the fact that their homes and everything they've ever owned were lost in fires.
And also, I believe the Red Cross has found that their blood supplies for the summer are low. So just something as simple as donating plasma.
Very, very easy.
Would actually go a long way.
Go down to the RV when you see it around at a shopping mall or wherever it may be and donate plasma. It's an easy, easy thing to do. You'll drink some juice and
free cookies.
You get a free cookie.
And a light head.
And you get lightheaded, yeah.
You can't beat that, folks. You can't beat that. Anyway, thanks very much for listening. It's been an awesome show. It's been a great honor to have you, Paul and Adam. We'd love to have you guys back whenever you'd like. Door's always open. Nope.
I won't leave. I got a pillow in the car.
Awesome.
My dog.
Where should we keep up with you, man?
And my dreams. I'm at Adam Sessler on Twitter. That is not me on Facebook. I have no idea who started that. They just have low aspirations in the dream life.
Don't worry, you're not missing me. You know what? I created a Facebook page, and I have some folks I talk to there, but it's not a big deal.
But yeah, if I'm going to create a Facebook page, I'll be Brad Pitt or Obama, not me. So the guy who wants to be me, who the hell are you? God.
It's Brad Pitt and Obama. They teamed up.
Yeah.
Brad Obama.
I'm trying to tell myself that.
Paul?
I am also not on Facebook because I'm a middle-aged man, and that would be weird. But I am on Twitter at Paul Semmel. No, just at Paul Semmel. So come say hi.
At Paul Semmel. And don't forget, of course, always, obviously, every day, Totally Rad Show.
That's right.
Coming up, movie reviews for
Spider-Man this week. Yeah.
Does whatever a spider can.
Yeah.
So, and any other cool stuff?
Yeah, we got lots of cool stuff. I think there's some TV stuff that we want to be talking about. Oh, episodes. We're talking about episodes. Have you guys watched that? It's a great show.
Yes. Oh, I like that show.
I like that show.
Comic-Con plans?
We have a live panel. Thank you for teeing that up. Friday night of Comic-Con at 8 o'clock, room 24 ABC. So please show up to that. It'll be a blast. It's going to be a big party. Fifth year in a row we've had a panel. So.
And you still have 1 week to see...
my underpants play.
We want to see you in underpants. If you want a chance to see Jeff in underpants and you are in the Los Angeles area, you can still see him there. So there you go, folks.
JeffCanada.com is where you find info for that.
All right, so come by ShackNews.com. Tell us what you thought of the show. We will all be in there playing around with you in the thread. And until next week, that's your Week in Confirm. Thanks very much. We are Ghost. Work so hard that we play harder. Work so hard, don't you know we play harder? Yeah, come on. It took a minute for me to see what was going down. My body's vibrating, pulsating to the sound. Hey, bartender, hit me with another round. I gotta feel she's ready. Week in Confirmed is brought to you by Game Center, the must-have app for gamers. Game Center is filled with game information, the latest gaming news from ShackNews.com, and videos and screenshots for over 7,000 games. Game Center is free and available now for the iPhone, Android, and Palm mobile devices.